Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Free Nintendo. It's number 290. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, are James Jones.
Hi.
John Lindemann.
Pleasure is all mine, Johnny.
And Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
We are going to have a big show for you today. We've got a lot of really exciting listener mail. Our cups have been overflowing.
Our protective cups.
With listener mail lately. So we're going to catch up with several of them in the second half of the show. And be sure to stick around through the entire episode. We've got a big announcement coming up at the end also. But first up is new business, and Greg is first.
Yep. One game I'm not going to be able to really talk about, because I only just downloaded it today, but I thought I'd mention it, as I did get the Game & Watch Gallery 2 for Game Boy from the eShop, but I thought I'd mention that apparently because this is such a rare event in America now, actually getting a Game Boy game of any
description. Yeah, I know. It started with such thunder, and now we get...
We get nothing. I think...
Sounds shockingly familiar.
I think the last... I think the last virtual console game we got on eShop at all was back in February, and that was the Game Gear stuff.
Well, Game Gear was a little bit more recent than that.
Oh, okay. Well, then that must have been the last time we had a Game Boy game, then.
That's right. Well, I believe there's been all of 2 Game Boy games this year on the American eShop released, because, of course, there have been NES games and Game Gear games. So,
and 3D classics.
Yeah, they've been sparse in general, but the Game Boy component has really trickled down to nothing. So I thought I'd rub it in a little bit. I'm sorry.
It just really makes you wonder, like, what their approach is, because you would think that they would have a roadmap for the year of what they're going to release or something that would make sense.
Yeah.
They have a roadmap, but it's actually a roadmap of Washington, which means it's all one-way streets and closed-off roads and
and DuPont Circle.
I think the curious thing about it is the disparity between America and Europe in this. We're very used, collectively, Europe and America, to being left in the dust on virtual console by Japan. But there is a very marked disparity now, as I alluded to with the Game & Watch Gallery 2 example, that Europe has got something like 5 Game Boy games this year compared to 2. Wario Land, I've already talked about on the show, for instance. I mean, they're up to Wario Land 3 in Japan now, but, it's nice they've got the first one out in Europe, at least. It's strange whether this continues to be a case of they have more 3DS-ware, so to speak, stuff that they want to focus on in America, and they're rigidly sticking to a one piece of software kind of thing.
I mean, the weird thing to me is that these are digital titles. They should be essentially evergreen releases, and especially with the way that eShop is set up now, it's pretty good about giving you recommendations and having sort of categories set up where you can go and sort of explore different things that are already on the shop. So I don't think they're as tied to the immediacy of the, what little attention they get when they first release something on the shop. That was kind of all they had on Wii and with DSi too, I assume. So now that eShop is kind of a more functional marketplace and a functional store where they can highlight things and get your attention with certain things, if you think about like the sum total of all sales they will ever get for these games, the earlier they release it, the better, because then it's out there for longer, and so I just don't understand the idea of hanging on to things if that's what they're doing.
The only downside to releasing a specific title is that it may undercut the sales of another title.
Right. And that's just not going to be the case with the stuff that's coming out right now.
Well, it's interesting as well, because obviously I'm not going to say that every worthwhile Nintendo game on the platforms is out on the virtual console, because there's definitely some prominent omissions, first-party omissions that we've talked about. Some of them, maybe there's technical issues like Yoshi and Star Fox, etc. But you could argue credibly that, with Wii Virtual Console, we got to a point where they got a lot of their own stuff out, and then you're almost more dependent on third-party games.
Right, which they have less control over.
Yeah, and in Japan, they've succeeded in doing that, mainly through Neo Geo and, sometimes the run of Namco arcade games and all that. They've made it work in Japan, and then maybe outside of Japan, for various reasons, you haven't been able to do that. But with the Game Boy situation, it's completely different. Because as you said, we are still nowhere near exhausting Nintendo's offerings for the original Game Boy, for the Game Boy Color. We're pretty much early on in that, and yet still these disparities that we might have thought were down to those factors before have endured under completely different circumstances. So it is making me kind of reconsider, you know, what is driving some of these things.
Yeah, you know, and with Nintendo's new announcement of the whole digital sales thing, that we'll talk about it more in listener mail, but it gives me pause, and it makes me wonder, like, how much do they really have their shit together in releasing games digitally? Because they just, their history has been so spotty.
Well, it's a question of priorities as well, but I do look forward to playing Game & Watch Gallery 2 anyway. But in terms of what I have been playing, I would like, first of all, to wrap up from where I was last time I was on with Rhythm Thief for 3DS. So last we spoke, I was kind of at the beginning of the final act of the game, as it were. In terms of some of the concerns that I had at that time, I think the difficulty having been very gentle and all that, there was a satisfying increase in that kind of complexity as the game came to a close. Definitely some concepts were brought back in a more kind of challenging form, or they mixed some together and things. I was quite happy with how much they took it up a notch as the game went on. The adventure stuff remains lightweight for the whole thing. It never takes on any kind of greater complexities. You just solve like really simple sound based puzzles at times and touch the screen a bit, and that's about it. So really I would say the adventure stuff is most effective in just kind of communicating the story and the world to you, you know, talking to all these characters and stuff. It doesn't really have that much substance to it in a gameplay sense, but because, you know, the world is quite pleasantly constructed, it's not super tedious to go through it or anything. And then with the one thing that helps in that regard is I do think the localization with the writing and stuff is solid. It's pretty good, you know, I mean, it's not heavyweight stuff, the writing or the story or anything like that, but I think it's quite well executed. Oh, there's some strange cases where the voice acting that there is, you know, because you've got some animated scenes and then a limited amount of the static talking heads bits are actually voiced as well. The voice acting occasionally does not match the text, which I thought was strange, but just little differences in a few little phrases here or there. I've no idea why. But the actual voice acting is okay. It's a weird fudge of accents, because obviously it's set in France, but a lot of the characters actually speak with British accents, and significantly more authentic British accents than Professor Layton, I would say. In fact, there's one character who, you know, have a father-daughter relationship. The father has this big cartoon French accent, and the daughter sounds like Luke from Layton.
Oh, God.
That's pretty strange. So you got the cartoon French accents, and then Raphael, the lead, the protagonist, is American in voice. So it is a very weird kind of mix of stuff. But in general, they sound pretty good, and they do a decent enough job communicating this sort of story, which definitely towards the end it reaches latent levels of mad, colossal stuff. I don't know whether it surpasses the end of the third one for that, but it's similar. Although I would say one thing about the way the story ended was that it did not kind of all wrap up conveniently in a little bow as much as I was expecting from stuff like Layton. There was actually quite a lot of stuff that was kind of unresolved. That, are they hoping for a sequel? I don't know whether the sales will ever justify it.
Whether the Sega's economic condition can afford one.
Yeah, after the restructuring, their very obvious prioritization of stuff that's, you know, name brand Sonic and Aliens or whatever, it seems unlikely they'll ever get a sequel, which is a shame in my view, because I have really enjoyed this and it is very good, but I think there are some key areas where a sequel could have done it some good in terms of maybe increasing some of the complexity of these adventure game elements so they don't feel quite as routine as they do here, and also getting past that early system phase of let's use the gyro, because that is the kind of thing that happens early in console's life. You know, think of Castlevania Dawn of Sorrow with doing the seals.
Yep.
This is something that even, you know, the biggest developers, Konami, Sega, whatever, they get caught up with early on that they probably wouldn't later on. Like I said, that kind of crap disappeared from the latter day DS Castlevanias. And so I think if you had another Rhythm Thief game and they focused it more on the stuff that actually works, it would be really, really good. As it is, it's very good, but some of these little missteps here and there hold it back from being a truly kind of excellent experience. But there are some additional kind of incentives to master it, to get better grades and stuff, to the point that I've played it for more than 10 hours now. So it's a bit longer than maybe some of the reviews might have led you to think. I guess I should mention the grading method is something that's come in for a lot of criticism. And it's a little, I guess if it's like anything that I've played before, it's like a when done, but it does feel less fair. I've heard some people refer to it as being broken, which I'm not sure I agree with that characterization entirely, because I think the developers did intend the way that it sort of makes you play to an extent, but it's still dubious, let's put it that way, because what happens is you accumulate, as you get beats right in the course of a rhythm game, you kind of accumulate points, and you're kind of starting from being really close to failing and then building up this kind of reservoir of points that if you make a mistake, it'll drop. And if you keep dropping, it would fail you out of the song ultimately. But as you build them up, you go through the grades from E or ultimately up to A. But what this means is that if you make a mistake in the middle of the song, it's quite possible that you could easily recoup that loss and still finish with an A. If you make the same mistake at the end of the song, what would otherwise be a flawless performance becomes a C grade, for instance. And so I can see why people find that kind of objectionable. But at the same time, I do think it was a conscious choice to kind of make you feel the pressure more at the end. And very often the games will throw more complicated stuff as the sort of finale to it. So yeah, kind of what they're asking you to do is more difficult at the end of the song, and if you screw it up in terms of the grade, it's a big penalty. But the only real incentive to get the good grades is purely to unlock a particular, it's actually one, I think, one particular bonus chapter at the very end. And I'm a few away from actually doing that, mostly those gyro ones, which are certainly not much fun when they get more difficult. But having played the other two bonus chapters, they're just sort of like little other aspects of the story, like taking place before or after and stuff like that. I wouldn't worry too much about those. You know, if you really do not get on with the grading system, if you find it horribly unfair, I'm not sure it's worth like really pushing through it or anything. So overall, I've got quite a lot of use out of it. I'm really impressed with a lot of aspects of it. I'm sure a lot of people are going to enjoy it when it comes out in July, is it, in America. And definitely the animated sequences I was quite impressed with. They look great in the 3D. Yeah, they don't look like compressed or anything like that. You know, they look really sharp and clear on the screen. Great production values on that.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it a lot. Rhythm Thief, July. I don't know why we're waiting so long, but I'm very much looking forward to it. I think it'll be a nice summer game. There's a lot of stuff coming out in July in Japan, but in the West, I think it's mainly Rhythm Thief and Theater Rhythm that we know of right now.
And of course, New Super Mario Bros. 2 in August.
Yeah, yeah.
But one thing that I have to talk about that's new for this episode is from the Japan Virtual Console, appropriately enough, given our previous little topic there, is Metal Slug 3, which has already been announced. Into speaking of foresight, Nintendo of Europe already put this on the quarterly release schedule for the European Virtual Console for the second quarter of this year. So we've still got a couple of months when that apparently will become coming out in Europe, but it came out in Japan a couple of weeks ago. I downloaded it because this is my first Metal Slug game.
Really?
Yeah. I mentioned when I talked about playing Last Resort, the shoot 'em up, that was my first ever Neo Geo game. I mean, I had a friend once brought up, I think, the anthology or so. I must have played it for like a couple of minutes and like saw him play a little bit of it, but that is the extent of my Metal Slug experience.
There was a GBA version that I thought you might have picked up or something like that. I mean,
and there was one for the DS as well, but they were never, it was always kind of like, well, it's Metal Slug, but it's not like the full fat Metal Slug, you know, right. Like the real deal. And I mean, there's been on Virtual Console, there's already been Metal Slug games, but certainly from what I had read into, the third one had a lot of praise that it was, you know, one of the best. And so I thought, I didn't really fancy buying the anthology and having loads of these games that are kind of the same and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So, and of course, this wait turned out to be a lot longer than I ever expected. And I just kind of forgot about Metal Slug for years, you know, because the second one came out years ago. So you would think the third one would come out fairly soon after. Well,
especially since they'd already done the ROM on a disc version of it.
Yeah, and also Neo Geo games come out in Japan, as I keep joking about, all the time, but they just didn't release this one. So, you know, it's finally come out. It is quite a latter day Neo Geo game. It's from 2000.
What? Really?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. If you look at it in still shots, it looks nice, but it still looks like a game that's, you know, from the mid-90s or whatever. But, I mean, in motion, certainly, and again, bear in mind, I haven't played other Metal Slug games, so I'm not saying anything about it relative to other ones. But in motion, you know, it makes most games from the mid-90s look like South Park or something, you know. I mean, the animation is so much more vivid. There's so much little details and very cartoony. It's really beautiful. Like, actually, the aesthetic in a backwards way reminds me of Time Splitters. I wonder if they were inspired by Metal Slug in some way. It's got a lot of that about it. But yeah, it's gloriously silly stuff and pretty damn simple, even for a run and gun. Gameplay wise, the only real dynamics are you get some vehicular parts.
Yeah.
And then you will also get some scrolling shooter type segments underwater or in the air, which change things up a bit. But most of what the game's doing is just throwing intense amounts of shit at you and you having to deal with it. That's pretty much the game. And you could just enjoy the craziness of it. And I certainly have. One of the most impressive aspects to me was when I discovered that the levels have alternate paths. I mean, I did not know that, but I was playing the third level, which is set underwater. And there's actually two alternate paths. They both end up with you fighting the same boss, but one of them, you go deeper underwater and you're like shooting in a submarine. You know, it becomes a kind of scrolling shooter. And the other one, you go out of the water and are going along these sort of gratings on like an armored ostrich, kind of like espresso or whatever he's there, out of dog country with this like laser gun mounted to it.
Ostriches with freaking laser beams.
Pretty much. Yep. And you're decimating all these soldiers with that. It's completely mad. The second level's got an interesting premise because it's like a zombie theme. But they like sick on you and you turn into a zombie, but you're not dead yet. You're just really fucking slow. And if you keep killing stuff, you can actually get a cure for the zombification and come back to life without losing a life. However, you're so crippled. I found that really difficult to do. So it's just best to avoid getting zombified in the first place. But I mean, I'm at the last level now, and the last level is completely bonkers and ridiculously long. You start off in the sky, just shooting, you know, planes, all this stuff, and then you come down to the ground and you're attacking like a convoy, and then you blow up these trucks and they explode in stuff like a hail of pigs for no apparent reason, and the pigs cause horrific slowdown. Like, there's so many of them on the screen,
but it was so important to what they were trying to convey with the game that they had to be in there. It's an artistic statement, Greg. I mean,
it's so weird. Like, it is generally, I mean, there is slowdown in the rest of the game, but it's not that bad. You know, it's generally pretty good.
I can just see that, right? Like QA comes in and they're like, you know, these pigs, they cause a lot of slowdown.
No, the pigs are non-negotiable.
It's kind of a Metal Slug feature, though, that there just randomly be these moments of intense and crippling slowdown where you're just like, okay, thanks, game.
Yeah, well, I guess, but then you go through the convoy and then you fight this boss in a helicopter that's got a rocket launcher and all this kind of stuff. You're manning like an anti-aircraft gun and all that. And then you kill him and then a squid pops out of his head and gets into a flying saucer and kidnaps you, at which point one of the other playable characters then sort of steps up to the plate, gets in a rocket ship, at which point turns into a vertical space shooter. And then that goes on for ages. You get it. You penetrate the UFO.
Oh, is this Choaniki?
And then there's, you have to fight like a hive full of squid people. And I was like, you had no real idea that there was going to be any of that kind of stuff in it. We're going into it blind. It's just completely overwhelming how mad it is. So I mean, I've had a great time with it. I mean, it's simple, kind of silly fun, but the artistry of the graphics and just, you know, the imagination in it, definitely will make you smile a lot. And of course it's all that action. I mean, I'm not a big fan of, you know, because it's a Neo Geo game arcade, all that the continues life thing is kind of structureless. You've just got a default number of them, but sometimes it does kind of feel like, well, if I master this one bit well enough, I can just completely brute force the next bit. I don't like that kind of thing. I prefer like more well thought out checkpoints that you would get for a home game.
Yeah.
And also the bosses are kind of good. I do quite like them, although the attack patterns aren't necessarily that intricate, but they're horribly bullet spongy. They end up just going too long for me. Again, I think a product of its arcade origins, but I'll take it. There's a trade off. It's pretty damn good.
Well, Greg, I'm not surprised you enjoyed Metal Slug, knowing how you feel about Contra. And Metal Slug is a little bit different style. It's more slow paced in general, I would say, and not as jumpy as Contra in some cases.
No, there's not a lot of jumping.
Yeah. But I wonder if you ever played Alien Hominid.
I get that. I think it's say exact same scenario. I think it was at the same time that with the Metal Slug anthology. I've seen Alien Hominid and played it trivially, but not actually owned it.
Well, it's awesome. It was a GameCube release, and it came out on Xbox and PS2 as well, I think. But if you like Metal Slug, you should definitely play Alien Hominid, because it's very, very similar. It's very much has the same kind of pace. I think there's some tributes to Metal Slug in there, and it also has this great sense of humor that's very deliberate and intentional. And the other great thing about Alien Hominid is that I feel like the bosses are extremely imaginative. And that's a game also where you can actually pilot a UFO. So, pretty good stuff, yeah.
No, I've always heard good things about that, to be fair.
Well, it is awesome. You should check it out if you've never have. Okay, James, you're up next with new business.
Yeah, last year I went ahead and I reviewed the 3DS Ace Combat Assault Horizon Legacy, which at E3 2011 looked like an unmitigated disaster, and actually turned out to be an interesting game that had nothing to do with Ace Combat Assault Horizon, which I also saw at E3 2011, which is like an interesting experiment.
Okay, so what is this game? What's the platform? There's so many damn Ace Combat games, I can't keep them straight.
This is Ace Combat Assault Horizon for the 360, also on the PS3. This is the Ace Combat spinoff that came out last year that passes off the semi-real but semi-almost magical world of the Ace Combat series and actually sets it in the real world. It attempts to take out some of the goofiness of the Ace Combat franchise, which is kind of endearing. It's like an endearing level of just silliness. It tries to take it out and be more gritty and realistic. And it replaces the very, very straightforward combat mechanisms of Ace Combat with a melange of gameplay styles, including the dogfighting stuff that the Ace Combat series is known for. There's like helicopter piloting stuff where you pilot an Apache. There's some stuff ripped straight out of Call of Duty where you're controlling the guns on an AC-130.
Those are fun in Call of Duty. Those are really fun.
Yeah.
It is enjoyable, but it is ripped straight out of Call of Duty. And in fact, this game entirely is ripped straight out of Call of Duty, except for the fact you're in the air and not on the ground. And I can say this without any form of exaggeration, because the plot is, and I'm not kidding, you could stop me if you've heard it before, you are in North Africa / the Middle East fighting a rebellion inside of a country that is threatening to overtake it with the support of international forces, and then find that Russians are working with them, and in the end, a Russian terrorist group launches a coup inside the Russian military and comes into possession of a nuke.
Oh, wow, that sounds very familiar.
Do they then invade the United States?
Yes, they did.
Wow.
So that's for anyone who's not aware, that is pretty much the exact storyline of the Modern Warfare series.
It is. And in fact, there's a scene where you were in the AC-130 blowing up the exact same part of the world you blow up in Modern Warfare.
Wow.
Is this like the side story to that game?
Yeah.
it's almost creepy how much it mirrors this game. And in fact, even in its cutscenes, it kind of mirrors the game. I mean, the cutscenes in the Ace Combat series are really lush. They spend a lot of time on them. They're goofy as hell. I mean, there's about 30 minutes of cutscene videos in Ace Combat 6 devoted to this golden statue that the country that you're in regards as like a living god.
Wow.
This game, nope. You walk to airplanes, you give each other meaningful glances, you get in airplanes, then you blow things up. It's really kind of a weird experience. I mean, the air combat, the fighter combat is pretty similar to the previous games. The scale has been toned way back though. So they've essentially integrated the system that first showed up in Skycrawlers, where if you get in position, you can hit a button and get right behind somebody.
Oh, yeah.
Now, in Skycrawlers, it made sense because you didn't have missiles. In this game, you have missiles, so it makes no sense. But there are essentially some enemies that you just can't shoot down unless you do it. But it takes away a bit of the drama of what makes those Ace Combat games really neat, because a lot of times it's you flying into like a formation of 50 fucking airplanes who are all shooting at you at one time. And you switch to some mythical special weapon, fire it off, and you see the whole sky just erupt into fireballs. That doesn't really happen in this game. And in fact, the whole game itself feels much more compact. The missions are much tighter. There's not a lot of things going on. Oh, and you can beat it in 5 hours.
Is that short for the Ace Combat franchise?
Oh, God, yeah. Usually you get knocked around for a while. So there's only about 16 missions. Most of them take about, 10 minutes. But the Ace Combat games usually have about 16 missions, but there's alternate missions you can take, and inside missions there are branching paths. There's none of that here. It's not as hard as those games. The objectives are much more concise. It's much more linear feeling. So in the end, it just feels like it takes a lot less time to get through them. Hmm. So I actually beat the game in a sitting, and the credits started rolling. I'm like, wait, what?
So a sitting for you is 5 hours?
It's a little bit under five. It was like four something.
That's funny. That's very telling, James.
The credits just roll, and I'm like, really? That's it, huh?
So it sounds like they emulated Modern Warfare right down to the length of the campaign, but did they emulate the multiplayer mode?
So there is a multiplayer mode. That's not unusual for the franchise. I haven't found that it's very active at the moment. I remember in 6, Fires of Liberation, it was basically just a big fucking dogfight. And a lot of times what would happen is if you came in with this plane, you had to go through hell and back to unlock. Like, you had to beat the most difficult pilot in the game in the most absurd dogfight ever at the hardest difficulty level that you have to beat two high difficulty levels to unlock. Then you got his airplane. So it's like, okay, you have officially fought God and punched him in the face. You can now have this airplane. And I remember in that game, if you had it, everybody tried to shoot you down immediately, which was fun. In this game, it's just like people going around and not doing much of anything. It just doesn't feel exciting. It's definitely not a multiplayer-focused game. Hmm. It's still very much trying to push the Ace Combat franchise. And it's a shame because it doesn't really have the things that make me want to go back and replay those stages. You know, I don't get the cinematic feeling of like, I am the biggest, baddest motherfucker out here. Because it's you're not. And I don't have the branching paths to go explore. And it's a linear game. And there's no alternate missions. It's just not there in the same way that it is for other games in the series. And even the 3DS game, man, I probably got 12, 13 hours out of it. I don't know that I'll get more than one or two more hours out of this game, which is really upsetting. Also, in 5 hours, I had 35 out of the 50 achievements, so...
Wow.
That's kind of sad.
Yeah.
There is something interesting, though, to be flying about through Moscow, just hiding behind buildings that apparently are completely indestructible. Because Russia has the best construction materials ever, apparently.
Russian engineering is very robust, let's put it that way.
Basically, there's a lot of like flying below house level in an Apache helicopter at like 130 miles an hour. Just down streets, just blowing the shit out of anything that got in your way.
It's absurd. A simulation, James, a simulation.
But the best part of it would always be like you'd hide behind a building and they just unleash holy hell on the front of the building. You're like, yep, that doesn't hurt. And you'd fly up over it and shoot them and duck back behind the building.
So it's like, you're just using buildings as cover.
It is Modern Warfare. I was using the buildings as cover in my helicopter. Oh, it's fucking bizarre. It's the weirdest. It's such a weird spin-off game that I don't even know what they're going to do with it. I struggle to think they're going to make another one like this. I have to imagine they'll go super retrograde and make a traditional one, because this is Namco Bandai, and that's kind of the way they are.
Yeah, they'll probably just remake Ace Combat 3.
Well, I mean, they just did 2. Give them some time.
Okay, so, John, you're up next. Staying in the stereotype category for new business. You and James.
Yeah, NHL 94, of course. I actually did get to play it online a little bit.
How bad did you lose?
Did you lose any games in triple overtime?
No. Nice. Nicely played. Well played, Greg. Yeah, I actually did lose. I did lose a game in overtime. I lost 5-4. And a lot of it, of course, varies on which teams you choose. Even though if you're playing a good player that actually knows the game fairly well, if they see you choose an awful team, like at that time, like the worst team in that game is Florida, the Florida Panthers. There's no way they're going to pick unless they're just a total jerk, which is, that happens. But if they respect you as an opponent, they're going to choose a team that's equally as bad. So,
John, I'm sure you'll appreciate this. This is a bit of a tangent, but, you know, growing up in the South, which Florida may technically not be part of the South, depending on who you ask. But I did not grow up watching hockey. I know this is a huge shock. I've never played hockey. I barely know the rules to hockey, and I've watched maybe 5 hockey games in my entire life, usually when hanging out with Canadian people. and those were like at sports bars, you know. But I was in Canada last weekend for a friend's bachelor party, and we went to the Real Sports Bar in Toronto, which is ESPN voted it the #1 sports bar in North America.
Yes.
And you walk in, and you will see why, because they have literally a movie theater screen on the wall on which they show the biggest game, whatever's playing at the time, and about 100 smaller TVs surrounding it. So it looks like the lair of some James Bond villain, basically. And I found, now, yes, I had been drinking, but I found that watching hockey on this enormous screen where the players are literally life-sized on the screen,
yep.
I found that I could actually follow the puck.
Yes. Well,
without the Fox Sports glowing trail behind it, that was good times. You know, you have to dumb that game down for the Americans. They can't follow that puck.
Well, I mean, being able to watch hockey on TV is one of those things where you do kind of have to learn it. Like, you have to get used to it, and you know, it's like learning Smash Brothers. You have to build up your visual acuity and your ability to understand what's happening in the game and actually be able to follow the puck and keep your focus on it. It was a lot easier on that giant screen.
It's definitely a sport that benefits a lot from HD in the home setting. Even if it's not a huge screen, just the better clarity really does help.
The ice on HD, when I first got HD, was a revelation. But I mean, like, I got a friend with a 65-inch TV, and when we watch hockey on it, it's unbelievable.
You know, if I had a TV that big, I would probably watch hockey a lot more often. I actually had I really enjoyed myself watching it. I think it's the most intently I've ever watched a hockey game, and it was the most I've ever understood it and gotten into it.
Yeah.
But John, I really want to hear about how your online hockey game went.
Yeah, well, you know, I will say, just playing it online, I mean, you can pretty much play it peer to peer, which is much better. And then you can, they also do have servers set up, which kind of lag. There's a little bit of lag time there, so it's not as smooth. You know, it's always best when you're playing a game against somebody to just hook up peer to peer. But yeah, plays really well online, and it's as good as I remember it. So it's just it's pretty much that game. I mean, if you want a game that just purely makes me happy and giddy, that's the game, man.
When you're losing at it repeatedly.
Even when I'm losing, because the thing is, I know the team so well, and all of these players. I mean, the whole game is like a hockey snapshot. So you remember all of the corny players from that time period.
Oh, and there's so many corny players in that time period.
And there's so many, like, just little things. Like, you know, you get beat by somebody who beats you with just a terrible player. And it's just, it makes it even funnier, because you're like, oh my God, I got beat by so-and-so. It's like they'll score with, like, their complete goon player who is just, was, at the time, was a nobody. But in that game, because he can't be checked, you can just, you know, bounce off 3 guys and then score on the other person.
Is goon actually like a player type that you can select?
Not officially, but there's goons. There's definitely goons.
Do you think this game is iconic enough and has enough of a cult following that there could ever be like some kind of sort of retro tribute game release that kind of updates it with modern graphics and gives it real legitimate online play
that? We had a conversation about it on the show before, where basically John and I were going, we would pay for this game, EA.
Oh, God. I mean, that's the thing. They could take that game right there, and they could just port that, put all the new players in there, and I would pay for it.
You know, like with Tecmo Bowl on DS, you know, they kind of tried to do that. I'm not sure how successful they were, but
yeah.
Well, you like that game, John. I just don't know how much it sold, really.
Well, the problem with that game was the fact that they didn't have any NFL players in it. So at that point, it's just meaningless. And I mean, that's the thing. EA would still be able to put all the real NHL players in there.
They could call it NHL 94 2013.
Yeah, it would be amazing. Like, and I wouldn't even want like the whole HD treatment cleanup kind of thing. Just keep it exactly the way it is with all of the bugs intact, all of that crazy stuff. It's just, it plays so well and it's so fun to play. I feel like in the newer NHL games and just most new hockey games, period, they try to load it up with so many different ways to control your guy, so many different ways to score and shoot, set up one-timers. There's all this like layers of crap where it actually abstracts you from playing the game. So a lot of times you actually feel like you have less control over what you're doing on the ice than what you do in just this simple game where there's, I mean, it's on a controller with three buttons.
John, did you ever play any of the Mario Strikers games? It's the only kind of new games that I think are kind of fun in a similar way.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, I've played some of them. Actually, I have Mario Strikers Charged
for Wii.
Yeah, and it's fun.
I always wanted to play those. I mean, the developer is really good. It's the Punch-Out guys, right?
Next Level.
Yeah. And the Luigi's Mansion 2 guys.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's almost more like hockey than football or soccer. You know, how fast-paced the number of people there are and the way you just jack people up really badly.
Yeah, I just don't know why games like that aren't in vogue right now, really. Like, even, like, you know, we were talking about, like, NFL Blitz, even though NFL Blitz did just come out.
Yeah.
I don't know. Those just aren't, like, for sports games, those just kind of aren't.
I think there's a certain amount of trepidation about putting the license on any game like that right now.
That's
true. And I think.
But then on the other hand, there's a perception if you don't have the license, it will bomb.
Right.
Man, the last hockey game that I played for any amount of time was Wayne Gretzky 3D hockey for the N64.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember it being pretty fun, but you have to remember this came out at a time when we would rent literally anything that came out for N64.
Yeah.
Anything.
But actually, with 3D hockey, that's interesting, Johnny. A couple of years back, I actually bought like a full-size arcade cabinet.
Where is this? I haven't seen this at your house.
It's not at my house. It's a friend of mine has it still down south because I wasn't going to move it. So it's still sitting at his place. He doesn't care, but whatever. But yeah, so it's a full-size arcade cabinet with like four sticks because I wanted to turn it into like a MAME arcade machine, right?
Nice.
I put MAME on it so you can play everything. And it happens to be 3D hockey.
It's a Wayne Gretzky 3D hockey?
Yeah, it's the arcade version of Wayne Gretzky 3D hockey.
Wow. I mean, I remember thinking it was pretty cool because it had that guy from Pro Stars on it.
Yeah, it's not too bad. I mean, that actually, it's NBA Jam. It's NBA Jam turned into hockey.
Yeah, that's about right. And you know, EA released NBA Jam on the download platform, so they could easily make, you know, just a shinier version of the early hockey games. Yeah. It just said this is NHL Jam, although that was calling it Jam in NHL is like the antithesis of the NHL.
All right, guys. Well, I'm going to wrap up new business this week. And I guess before I get to the games I'm playing, I want to bring up a little tit for tat that went on Twitter today with me and Mike Sklens.
Was it about Apple?
No, it was not about Apple. It was about...
then Mike Sklens didn't tweet it. Someone else did.
That's right.
No. He responded to something because I read an article over at Shack News where they said that next-gen consoles have not been formally announced yet. So I sent this tweet to Garnett Lee and I said, what, Wii U hasn't been formally announced? And Mike took up the matter and argued with me that Wii U isn't really a next-gen console. It's like a half-gen step forward or something like that.
If only there was some precedent for this.
And I said, look, I mean, you know, you're making assumptions about specs that haven't been released yet and, you know, rumors about a console and, you know, all this stuff. But anyway, it kind of came down to basically Mike was arguing that, we don't know anything about the new PlayStation or Xbox yet, but his argument was that Wii U is probably not really a quantum leap over the current generation of consoles and it won't really be the next generation. And that's not really what Nintendo's going for. They're going for more of a Dreamcast thing. And I'm not saying that he's wrong there, but my argument and, you know, you can call this semantic, but I think it speaks to certain attitudes that people have about the gaming industry and about, you know, sort of the way that things progress. But I feel like the definition of a current generation across platforms is kind of moot. I think that's silly. I think it's predicated on this kind of false idea that consoles all kind of come out at the same time and represent a concurrent generation and that everyone moves on from that at roughly the same time. And that's never happened. Never have all the major platform holders released their new system at the same time.
They have, but within 2 to 3 years of each other, they have, though, or within a year.
Sure, within 2 to 3 years, but if the cycle is 5 years, then, you know, it's always staggered. And I guess my point is, there's no such thing as a current generation of consoles. There is the current generation of Nintendo's console, and the Wii U is next gen because it is the next generation of Nintendo's console.
You're being overly semantic, and he's being overly himself. I think that's the best way to look at it.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying, I just feel like the whole idea that next gen is a thing. It is only a thing relative to that platform.
Next gen is a magazine.
360 is the next gen of Xbox. It's not the next gen of the 128-bit systems or whatever. I mean, and that's why we don't use bits anymore, because they don't actually mean anything, and they don't really exist anymore, and they don't matter anymore.
Well, they exist. I mean, they're still a thing.
The reason my comment to Garnet Lee from the start was based on the fact that I feel like a lot of people aren't really taking Wii U seriously as, you know, a major development. I think people, and it's Nintendo's fault because they haven't talked about it in a very long time, really. And we still don't know very much about it, and they showed it really early. So, you know, I'm not necessarily saying that Nintendo isn't at fault here, but I think the idea that Wii U is just kind of like an upgrade to Wii, like a minor upgrade, and that it's at best catch up with where the other platforms already are, and that it's not really sort of the future of gaming, is really false. It is at least part of the future of gaming. And it may not be, you know, what you consider the next generation in terms of where those other platforms are going, but, you know, those guys may not have a huge upgrade either. If you look at the costs and their profit margins and the way that their current systems are selling. But I feel like the idea, the stigma that whatever Nintendo's doing next with their next system is not really next gen. You know, probably most of the people who listen to this don't really believe that, but I think that's a pox among the gaming media. And I hope Nintendo is going to show some stuff next month that will stamp that out and will get people to actually take them seriously. Anyway, to get to the games that I've played the past week, like I said, I was in Canada over the weekend. I had some international travel. I had some time on an airplane. And when I wasn't editing Discover Music Project, I was playing my 3DS. So I played a lot of Tales of the Abyss. I talked about this a few weeks ago, just very briefly, because I had barely touched it, had barely gotten into it. And I'm finally kind of getting into the meat of the game. I'm about a dozen hours into it, and I really don't have a sense for how long this is going to be. But it does feel like the story is picking up, and things are getting weird. Like, my characters are, I'm meeting some mysterious characters who I'm actually interested in. And the weird rules of the game that I kind of referred to last time, the strange terminology and the mysticism that they have about, you know, these particles that are floating around the planet and they give them magical powers. I'm not going to say it makes sense, but I have to admit, at this point, I've heard enough about it. I kind of understand what a seventh phonist is. So I never thought that would happen at the beginning of the game, but, you know, Tales of the Abyss is really well done. And I think if you are looking for like a nice meaty JRPG for your 3DS, I think it's a really good fit for the platform, and I'm enjoying it a lot. The combat at first seemed a little overly simple to me, but it's one of those things where, you know, every hour or two, they sort of give you a new mechanic. So they try to introduce you to this stuff slowly because there's a lot to do in the battles. There's a lot going on. And so over, you know, the first 10 or 12 hours, they've kind of reached a point for me where there's enough going on in the combat that I'm more engaged with it than I was before. I'm paying more attention. I'm blocking more often. And the enemies are getting hard enough that I actually do kind of have to think rather than just spam the attack button over and over again. And the battles are, if nothing else, fun to look at, because at any given time, there's usually 4 or 5 enemies in a battle, and also 4 characters in your party who are all running around and doing various things. You only control one of them, so the rest of them are all kind of on autopilot. They're busy, that's for sure. The battles are very busy. This is all in 3D space. You're running around, you're targeting different enemies, and you know, enemies can and will kind of gang up on you and attack you from behind and stuff like that. So in that sense, it works really well, and it definitely reminds me of some of the fun I had from Tales of Symphonia. And probably the, you know, other than the story and, you know, it's set in a different world. So the story and the narrative and the characters are all different. But the biggest change I noticed from Symphonia, is just the graphical style. You know, Symphonia was fairly bright and colorful. The main character wore this kind of red costume that really kind of leapt out of the screen. And the world was, I remember being sort of very green and blue and, you know, very kind of primary colors that looked very cartoonish. Tales of the Abyss is much more muted in the color palette and looks more like kind of a polygonal version of maybe like a Final Fantasy VI. You know, that game has that kind of rustic, brown, industrial look to it in a lot of ways, or sometimes just kind of a burnt vegetation look to it for obvious reasons in the World of Ruin. It's not that it's monochromatic by any means, but it has this kind of dull, morose quality to the graphics that makes it feel more adult, a little more serious than some of the games that had come out before it. And Abyss has that, you know, and that does help keep the story from feeling like it's going completely off the rails and being a completely ridiculous cartoon kind of story. That's kind of the main difference. Otherwise, it's a lot like Tales of Symphonia. So if you like that, you'll like this. And it's on 3DS. So having it portable is really nice. And the other game that I've been playing lately, not a whole lot in the past few days, but to just kind of generally, I've been trying to trudge along through Xenoblade Chronicles. So I figured since I sort of wanted to talk about two different JRPGs, I could compare them a little bit. And, you know, obviously it's a handheld versus a console, so I'm playing them very differently. Usually when I play Xenoblade, it's for a couple of hours at least. I try to at least, so that I can really get into it and move around. Certainly you can play it for shorter time periods, but I feel like you don't get nearly as much out of it because, you might sit down with Xenoblade and say, well, I want to at least get to the next major objective. And it might take a while to get there. You know, it might be a lot of walking, a lot of battling in between, getting lost a little bit or just exploring the map, getting sidetracked by some secret stuff. And it might take you an hour to kind of get to the next major story point that the arrow is pointing you to. And so if you play it for 10 or 15 minutes, you can do that and then save, you know, you might fight a few battles or whatever, but you won't feel like you've made a lot of progress, you know. So it is a game that you really want to sit down for a while. And the other sort of major difference between this and Tales for me is even though the voice acting is certainly far better in Xenoblade, and I don't mind listening to it at all in the cutscenes, but because the battles are so annoying, I might be tempted to turn the sound down and listen to something else maybe while I play it, which I often do in console RPGs. I did a ton with FF13. I listened to podcasts through most of that game because the audio just wasn't that interesting to me. But in Xenoblade, I resist that temptation because the music is so good.
Yep.
And, you know, you guys have talked about that a lot, and the music is absolutely wonderful, but it's juxtaposed with this fairly irritating combat, you know, battle audio that you get with all the little voice clips and everything. And so ultimately, I don't know how much I really like the audio presentation. It's like, it would be easier if the music was worse because then I could just not listen to any of it, right? But because the music is so good and I want to listen to it, I also have to listen to this other crap.
I think a lot of the ambient stuff when you're just walking around the world can be nice too, actually.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely.
Like there's a section that's in a swamp that when you're walking around it is absolutely amazing.
Mm. It's really beautiful too, especially at night that in the swamp when these weird kind of aurora lights come up and they're sort of swirling around over the bog. And it's really nice. I mean, the game is beautiful. And that kind of gets the other thing I wanted to say about it is that lately I've seen a lot of kind of weird criticism that Xenoblade doesn't look very good. And people are saying, oh, yeah, I love the game, but the graphics really suck. And, you know, this guy at Game Informer had this weird diatribe where it was kind of played up like a joke article, but basically ended up saying, you know, Nintendo needs to fix this shit. Gave some kind of ultimatum, like I'm never playing a Nintendo game again if they don't fix these kind of graphics in their next system. And it's weird to me because I feel like it's probably one of the better looking Wii games I've played.
Oh, definitely.
If you look at it in the context of the scale and the amazing environments that you, not just that they're big, but they're really beautiful and they all look different and interesting. And, you know, one of the things that keeps me coming back to the game is not the story, which I'm still kind of not sure how much I really care about it, but I want to see these places that they keep talking about. I want to go to the head of the Bionis. I want to see if I get a chance to go over to the other sort of planet, the Mechonis, and see what that place looks like. I want to peer over these weird vistas and, you know, like look up in the sky and see these fingers of this giant creature that I'm living on. You know, I went inside. I'm actually inside of the Bionis right now. I'm inside of the planet and it's living. There's stuff in there.
Right.
This is really fascinating material. And as a guy who likes to explore and likes to experience the world, I don't think you'll find many games that are better for it than Xenoblade. And the graphics are a big part of that because and the art design, you know, they have to make these places look interesting and inviting, or in some cases, threatening. And I think it did an amazing job of it. And I was thinking, like, where did all this weird criticism come from? Like, this is a game people should be praising the graphics for this game, not damning it.
See, I think people looked at the faces of the characters, which are admittedly messed up.
The faces aren't great.
And I think it sort of clouded their judgment on everything else. I mean, if you get right up on top of a texture, no, it doesn't look that great.
Right. But it's also, it's a standard definition game. It's not going to.
No, but if you stand out in the middle of the world and just look around, it's really amazing.
It is.
And that's the difference between graphics and art design.
Well, I think on a technical level, the graphics are great too, because they have to be able to pull off these environments, you know. But ultimately, I think the real reason for all this criticism, all this negativity about the way the game looks, is because it's getting reviewed by people who haven't actually played Wii games in a couple of years.
Yeah.
You know, and that finally a Wii game comes along that people tell them they really should play, and it's really amazing, and it has these great reviews from Japan and Europe, and has all this, you know, the underground movement to get it released here and everything. And all of a sudden you've got people who don't normally review games. A lot of publications probably no longer have sort of the go-to Wii reviewer that they had 2 or 3 years ago.
Or their RPG guy just got done with Skyrim.
Right. You could very well have an RPG editor who's never played a Wii game.
Well, and I suppose, I mean, the big issue really is that some of those rough edges are probably, if you're talking about people who are not as familiar with them, have not been sort of seeing them for years or whatever, are probably more jarring, more unpleasant, you know, more difficult to look past. Mm. And so it maybe tarnishes their ability to enjoy what is good about the visuals. I mean, for me, that was the game. The sights and the sounds, seeing the places, that was it. I mean, as not being the biggest RPG guy in the world, building up the characters, the story, skill links, affinity, it was incidental.
Yeah.
The journey was the whole game. If it wasn't worth looking at, I would not have enjoyed it one bit.
Yeah.
But obviously it was, because I played it through to the very end. So I do think, chiefly, you know, it is, as James kind of mentioned there, artistically, I think that's its biggest accomplishment. And, you know, the tech side of it at times is rough, and at other times is commendable for how it pulls off that vision. But you know, it gets the job done. I mean, I'm someone who plays very old video games and can find them enjoyable to look at, and can find a worthwhile visual journey in there, you know, to enjoy the artistry of them. So the whole, you know, tech supremacy, get this out of my eyes thing is just not something that I've ever had to deal with.
Right. I love when games are crazy technically accomplished. You know, I get a thrill out of that. I love seeing something on the screen that I've never seen before. I love to see people push those boundaries. But the lack thereof is not really a slam on a game. I always want to see a game do amazing things within the paradigm that it has chosen. I mean, you know, Fez is a game that appears in screenshots to be made of pixels. It's actually made of polygons. And it looks very retro, but once you see that world rotate, and once you understand that the game is actually 3D, and once you get a feel for the animations and all the really cool little special effects that they're doing, that game is gorgeous and is amazingly accomplished at what it sets out to try to do.
Well, and to me, the thing here is, if I look at the world, like the big broad view of seeing the world overall, if that was on an HD console, I would still think about as impressed as I am now when I see the game on the Wii. I mean, I don't know they could have done the big wide view any better.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe they put more shit in it, but I'm not sure that's really necessary. I think artistically, it did what it needed to do.
The game doesn't feel limited by the technology to me.
To me, though, when we get stuck in the techno supremacy and we get into this debate about the visuals good or the visuals bad, you miss what the game really does well, which isn't that it creates just some really amazing world. It's that it actually advances the Japanese RPG a whole generation. It is a next generation Japanese RPG, and it may be the first one this console generation.
I think FF13 is very sophisticated in a lot of ways in the way that it deals with its systems. You know, I think there are a lot of different ways that you can advance what used to be the kind of standard state-of-the-art JRPG. And I think these two games both take it forward in different directions.
See, I think that game, though, is just too controversial in how many conventions it does sacrifice. I mean, this, you could say Xenoblade doesn't really sacrifice any conventions. It just takes away the barriers that make the game unenjoyable. I mean, there's not really much sacred cow slaying going on in Xenoblade.
Well, it's a different thing, but I mean, in terms of the battle system, I think the fact that your characters auto-attack in Xenoblade, and that is a statistic when you equip new weapons and stuff, I think that is very significant, that you have cooldowns rather than magic points. You know, all these things
sure.
are really controversial, I think, but the controversy is minimal, for one thing, because not that many people are playing the game, and for another thing, because these are really emulating MMO-type RPGs. They're not... It's not that it's all that innovative. It's that it's a rare example of a Japanese RPG sort of cribbing good ideas from other genres and from other parts of the world. We just haven't seen that in a long time. They've been so insular. And I think it's good. Not that I want every new RPG to play this way, but I think it's good that they're branching out and that they're kind of mixing things together and trying new stuff. And it, you know, in a lot of ways, yeah, mechanically, the game does feel new.
To me, and that's what I kind of find surprising about a lot of the reviews I read, is that a lot of times, if they glow on the game, they talk about how, like, wow, this is really different from where I've been before in this genre, in this generation. And if they really just get stuck in the graphics, they don't mention, they don't go into the details of how the gameplay is different.
I don't know. I mean, to me, the thing that makes Xenoblade feel like the future of Japanese RPGs is that it takes something that really, we used to sort of take for granted back in the, let's say, 16-bit era, which was these big worlds that you can explore. You can kind of go anywhere. There's a lot of like fun hidden stuff that you can sort of take the game in a very nonlinear way. And that element of JRPGs, which is what I grew up on and what I loved the most about the genre, has really gone away in the past 5 or 10 years, because when developers got the new hardware, they found that stuff was sort of resource intensive to make, and they didn't want to do it. And so starting with FF10, you get a game where it's sort of this sequence of like areas that are strung together, but they never really feel like a wide open world. And when you get the airship, there's no big map that you can move around on. There's not even a world that you can fly through like you could with, let's say FF8, you know, 8 or 9, where
it's just rapid transport.
It's just a menu. It's a menu, and it says, which city do you want to go to? And it's like, well, you guys don't understand at all. And that was what was so glorious to me about Dragon Quest VIII, was it did take that kind of classic big world with lots of fun stuff to find, and it put it into 3D. But certainly with the current consoles, with 360 and with PS3 and even with Wii, you haven't really seen that. You haven't seen a big, wide-open 3D world that you can wander around in. And Xenoblade, finally, is that. And I think it's not that it's doing something new, it's that it's finally bringing that classic element into the modern era. To me, it's nostalgic to play this game and to be rewarded, literally get experience points for finding secret places, which you can't imagine having been done in FF13, FF12, FF10.
Well, typically that's something that you only find in MMOs, which I think is really cool, that they've actually cribbed elements from MMOs and actually successfully put them into a console game. I think it's really cool.
But and have avoided picking up
some of the bad things, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Whatever.
They've cherry-picked.
Whatever.
They've cherry-picked from MMOs.
John wants to have to beat 8,000 enemies to level up.
All right. So that's going to wrap up new business. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we've got your listener mail.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
We begin this week with a review for the latest 3DS eShop game that's not a virtual console game. That would be Block Factory. Neil Ronahan tells us that instead of making your own game, maybe you should just go and play Tetris.
That is an incredibly generic title for a game, by the way.
I'm always wary of video games with factory in the title.
Next up, we have impressions after last week's preview of Pokemon Conquest by Carmine Red. Don't call it Pokemon Tactics, that's only half the story.
The other half is dating Sims.
There's also a sexual component.
we At least I went there classily, John. Jeez.
I didn't even bother. Just cut out the middleman, James. That's what I always say.
Speaking of cutting out the middleman, we have a preview of 3DS's Luigi Mansion 2 by Neil Ronahan. Yes, just how long has Luigi's Mansion 2 been in development?
Maybe not as long as you think. That's kind of the answer.
Way to spoil it! We also have a video feature, Street Pass Experiments in Tokyo, where the Famicast crew pushes the 3DS Street Pass feature to its limits in downtown Tokyo.
We also have a feature, the Japan eShop Roundup by Danny Bivens. He says that people can get a free taste of Kingdom Hearts and Wario is back on the Virtual Console.
Once again, Wario Land 3.
Just rub it in, Greg. Just rub it in.
We also have a Mario Tennis Open guide by Neil Ronahan, where they lay out the characters and content in Mario's latest tennis game.
Tennis is one of the things in the content, by the way.
Next up, there's a blog called Setting the Odds on Call of Duty Black Ops 2 on Nintendo Platforms by Neil Ronahan. And now that it's officially been revealed, let's go over the likelihood of the latest Call of Duty game coming to 3DS, Wii U, Wii, and DS.
Well, it'll come to Wii because they already put up a Wii forum for the game and then took it back down. Way to go, Activision. Nicely done.
And finally, we've got a feature, NWR Game Club number 2, a game, well, it's somewhere in my heart. It's Metroid Other M. So our second Game Club dives into Nintendo and Team Ninja's divisive 2010 release. And so for the next month, for the month of May, there will be all kinds of feature content. You'll hear about some of it in future episodes of Now Playing. And there will be lots of stuff. And then there will be discussions also on connectivity. So you can check out all of this great original content over at the website. And also download some of our sister podcasts. So you want to check all of those out. You can find them all over at NintendoWorldReport.com. And we are back. It's time for listener mail. The address, as always, is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We've been getting lots of emails lately. We can't get to all of them, but we've picked out a few here, and we will continue to raid the backlog. Don't worry. We're going to always try to get to as many emails as we can. But, you know, we do tend to kind of dwell on them. And we read them out, so we can't do 20 in one episode. Anyway, Greg has the first letter this week.
I do. It's from a mysterious character known as JCZ in Japan, of all places.
I wonder who that is.
Greg, you should read this out in an American accent.
I would if I could. After listening about your Street Pass antics at PAX East, I couldn't help but feel bad for you guys a little. Living in Japan, I'm fortunate enough to Street Pass with up to 20 people a day, pretty much every work day, thanks to my commute on busy trains and buses. This allows me to slowly and steadily build up my puzzle pieces and progress through Street Pass adventure, considering my moves and paths carefully. However, cramming all of that into a few days, checking my 3DS every 20 minutes, basically grinding constantly.
20 minutes.
I don't really think I'd enjoy it as much. Yeah, that seems generous, doesn't it?
2 minutes.
Going from 0 to 300 in a day must tire your index fingers and your LR buttons immensely, making something that was meant to be fun a chore. Do you think Nintendo can, or indeed should, create more alternatives for people living in less densely populated countries and areas? Something involving a daily Spot Pass update, where a few people from a random city / state are dropped into your plaza, perhaps? Maybe if there was a system check that knew if you had single-digit Street Passes, it could come in and help you out a little. Things may improve over time, but not everyone takes their portable game systems to work / school with them every day. Even if the original DS had the feature with its 100 plus million units out there, do you think that would have been much better? Also, do you think the PS Vita's Neo is a better solution?
No.
If the rumor about the Wii U having some kind of electronic gamer's card that slots easily in and out of the controller is true, would that be a better solution, i.e. something without a screen that fits easily in your wallet?
Well, first off, how does Neo differ?
Well, it's got a name.
No one seems to understand what Neo actually does. It seems like
well,
really,
I mean, to be fair, that
it's half-baked.
That was always Sony marketing's goal, was to make it so you have no clue what the fuck their shit does.
But doesn't it look for Wi-Fi access points around you and then see who's connected to those? If there's other Vitas?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, and I think the goal for Nier is sort of that you would be able to find people to play local multiplayer games with, even strangers, which in Japan might be a really useful feature. In America, I would say it's even less useful than StreetPass. At least StreetPass is asynchronous, so you know it doesn't right. matter whether you notice that you StreetPass someone. You will find it later, and you say, "Oh, cool! I actually passed someone when I was in the train station or whatever."
Yeah, well, as someone who did not go to PAX East, I did have the Zelda concert to enjoy, which was before the update, which at the time I cursed my luck on that because I had already got everything by and large. But yeah, I mean, I could see in terms of the idea of maybe giving more opportunities for people to kind of get a leg up with some of this stuff, because of course the big difference that's come with the panels is the pink pieces, the ones that you yeah. can't get just by pumping play coins into it. You know, you've always had the play coins for hiring people in StreetPass Quest and getting random drawings of panel pieces. But the thing is, on the one hand, with the StreetPass Quest, the new update actually sort of made play coins more useful in that context, because you could hire people that you'd StreetPass with quite a lot of times. And right. so you could hire someone who was like a level 7 or something and then make some good progress that way. But with the panels, now you cannot complete them just by pumping in the coins. You've got to get these pink pieces by actually StreetPassing with people. And so, and don't forget, in the big ones, they actually have 8 pink pieces. So that could, I'm not that confident with some of these, how long it's going to take me to actually complete these panels. So,
well, that's the thing. I mean, I actually do get street passes sometimes, a couple a week probably. But the problem that I also run into now is that I have the puzzle pieces to all of them.
Yeah, you're just a carrier.
Up to the brand. Yeah, I'm just a carrier. So every person that I actually run into that I street pass, when their Mii comes in, they don't give me anything anymore.
Well, there's the new Mario Tennis puzzle that just came out like last week over Spot Pass.
Right. Yeah, you'll get stuff like
Everyone
that.
Gets a yep. random piece from that. So even if you have all the other ones full, and even if that's the only piece that some random stranger has, it's very likely to be a different piece than you got from Spot Pass. And so you can still trade. And that's how these things work.
And they'll keep doing that, clearly. All the big releases that right. are going to come out from Nintendo, they're going to have a panel for them, presumably.
Right. So my question regarding the pink pieces is, does everybody have the same pink pieces or are they different?
Well, I think what it is, everyone gets one piece of a panel. Like, just, when the update started, you got one piece from one panel. And presumably, right. if you were lucky, you got a pink piece to a panel. And so if you didn't get any pink pieces, in order to get them, you've just got a street pass with either someone who got a pink piece originally or with someone who street passed with people that have had pink pieces. So yeah, it's viral. They've probably been allocated just on a random basis, and then they've got to virally propagate over time, like what Johnny was talking about, freaky forms.
Yeah.
Over time it will get easier, but it's still, I'm kind of getting street passes at a rate similar to John, and every now and again I'll run into someone who does actually have quite a lot of stuff, and will have something that I don't have. A lot of the time it is people have got a lot less than me because they didn't go to the Zelda concert, or they probably don't right. use play coins as much as I do. But it is worth mentioning that they had the Iwata thing for the anniversary, where Iwata came to your 3DS by a spot pass, and he had everything, and you could use him as street pass quest and stuff. So that was a special occasion where you could kind of get a leg up from that. So there's a sort of precedent there for what JC is talking about.
I think that's how they would do it. Not that they would just sort of start randomly giving you pieces, but that they would make it some special event where some character or some famous person will sort of visit you, and then it will be as if you street pass them. But and part of the reason that they've implemented the pink pieces, and part of the reason that Street Pass 2 is so long and can be played multiple times, it has been played multiple times to get everything, is that Nintendo doesn't necessarily want you to have completed everything.
Yeah, they want it to last.
They want to keep stretching these things out and adding to them. And even for power users, they want to make you feel like there's always something for you to do. There's always something that you can get that you don't already have. Because once you have filled everything out, you're not going to mess with Street Pass anymore. Because you're no longer really getting anything out of it, right?
Yeah.
Once you've run out of things to spend your play coins on, which is why they added that to find me too. And, you know, and I'm really, really glad that they now have the ability to feed you new puzzles when new games come out. That's really cool. Again, it's supposed to be a game that's sort of unbeatable. Like, it's always supposed to feel like maybe it's within your grasp if you, you know, if you really try, if you always take your 3DS with you, and if you go to the right places or you just have the right habits. But they don't want it to be something that everybody can easily max out, because people complain the first time that happened.
Yeah, I guess just whether, you know, for people, I guess, who do you know, have these problems getting Street Passes more so. I mean, clearly, we all know, we have said before the system came out, you know, it seems like something that's designed with Japan in mind that will definitely work there. And, you know, it'll do all right in densely populated areas of other countries, but it is going to be problematic for other countries. I don't think there's really any way of getting around that entirely, but they could perhaps, once it has been a while since the update, you know, it wasn't that long ago at this point, they could consider making the pink pieces purchasable with play coins, you know, in a similar way to the non-pink ones are now, but like with a bigger play coin cost or something ridiculous, like 100 coins or something. Just like, okay, if you really want it, if you really want to sort of cheat to get this, that would be another option outside of parachuting Iwata in to help you out.
I think they should parachute Iwata like it's the Expendables every month. Just send him in. All right, take your peak pieces. I gotta get out of here.
Yep.
Let's do this.
You're gonna end up with this kind of cargo, online cargo culture where people worship him because they think he's a god.
Gold pants delivery service. Bring it.
But I mean, in terms of, you know, these sort of American style street passing where you get them all in this huge chunk and it's really sort of a chore to go through them and grind through them all the time. Yes, after 3 days of PAX East, I'm a little sick of it. But for most of the time, I'm really thrilled about it. It's partly because we've all been so parched for Street Pass.
Right.
You know, it is such a special event for us that we kind of don't care that it's this really tedious task of going through it. And also, the fun thing about Street Pass is that you meet, when you've got hundreds and hundreds, it's fun to kind of scan through all these people and see, where are they from? What do they look like? What are their names? What are their little sayings? So it's always different. It's not like it's just literally just holding down a button for hours and hours and hours. It's not like that.
You get excited when you get a new state. You're like, fuck you, Alaska.
Yeah.
It's you now.
You start to get this feel like you're actually completing things in these Street Pass quests that they give you. It's a fun feeling. It's an exciting feeling that we're all connecting in this way. It's great. I have no complaints about it whatsoever. You know, I think there could be improvements to it, but have you guys heard this rumor about the Wii U gamers card? I'm not familiar with this concept, but it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. Number one, because it would be competing with 3DS. So if they're going to do this, then they should just have the Wii U system tie in with your 3DS and use the street passes that you're already getting on your 3DS. That makes more sense to me. 3DS already fits in your pocket more or less. So I don't know the benefit there. The other reason, and we've talked about this before, but, you know, I can see there being some kind of detachable piece of Wii U that you could download stuff to at a retail store in case you don't have broadband at home. But that would just be a memory card. I don't know why that would need to have some kind of wireless functionality to make it more expensive and have to have its own battery and everything. I just don't really see. That seems very duplicative with what they're already doing with their handheld system. They would prefer for you to buy a 3DS if you're interested in doing that kind of stuff. I don't know what carrying something around with you all the time has to do with a console gaming experience.
Yeah, it seems like just kind of a very niche thing. It's the kind of thing it wouldn't surprise me seeing as kind of what... like, Nintendo has always sort of pushed that, oh, you know, take this over to your friend's house. I mean, they did that with Wiimotes, right?
Well, sure, it's free advertising.
Yeah, you know, where you could save something on your Wii remote.
You could save your Mii, yeah. I mean, how many of you actually did that?
Never, ever.
Never.
You know what, though? My Mii is on all of my Wii remotes. No, on my original two Wii remotes.
I don't even know how to store it on my Wii remote.
Oh, you go to the Wii Plaza and your Wii remote's just sitting there with the little icon. You just drag it on.
Yeah.
It's actually pretty straightforward.
It's the kind of thing, if you didn't do it right at the start, you wouldn't do it.
No, but I put it on there, and I brought my Wii remote to people's houses, but I never sat there and then unloaded my Mii onto their system so they could use it. I mean, it just never happened. Yeah. I didn't Noah's Ark myself onto their...
Yeah, you would want to kind of automate that, wouldn't you, probably, if he was going to bring that feature up to date.
Yeah, but again, they now have this feature built into... It's very integrated into their handheld system, and so if they want to include this kind of feature in the console, then they should just make it talk to your 3DS. They should have done that with Wii. So They need to figure out their connectivity issues, man.
Let's connect all of your tivities.
Okay, so James, you have the next letter.
8-Bits Deep writes, just had a few quick thoughts on your new Super Mario Bros. 2 discussion last week. I, too, am far less excited than I should be at the prospect of a new Mario platformer. I can't help but wonder if this game is a quick cash grab on Nintendo's part in the face of a record yearly losses. Since they're usually a bit more restrained in spacing out their biggest hits, this feels a little desperate to me. But what really makes me sad is the lost opportunity here. What better time than New Super Mario Bros. 2 to revisit long-lost gameplay style of the original Mario 2 on the NES? With the dual screens and 3D effects, there's all kinds of possibilities for Subcon. And who hasn't wanted a return of playable Peach with her classic float jump in a proper Mario title?
Okay.
Somebody needs to play Super Princess Peach, first off.
Yeah, Super Princess Peach. If you really love Peach in Mario 2, you should check that out. Also, I had to laugh when it talks about revisiting the long-lost gameplay and style of the original Mario 2, because...
Poison mushrooms is revolutionary!
The original Mario 2 is lost levels, and I think...
No one wants to revisit that. It is brutal sadism.
Well, and the problem, the reason that most people don't really love the lost levels is that it is exactly the same thing that we're complaining about with New Super Mario Bros. 2.
It is literally the lost levels. I mean,
it's just a remix of crap that was in the first game. It's not really a new game. I mean, it's technically a new release.
It's
but
it's a level pack. It's an incredibly difficult level pack.
Yeah.
The story goes that Miyamoto and Tezuka moved on to Zelda, and then
right.
The B team made it.
For my part, obviously, I wasn't here last week when you talked about New Super Mario Bros. 2. But yes, I'm not necessarily immediately all that excited because we haven't really seen hardly anything yet. And what we have seen is just a game that looks a lot like the other two games. And
yep.
If I was going to list the things that I really liked about New Super Mario Bros. And the Wii version, the aesthetic would not really be one of them. And that's pretty much all we've seen of yes. This game. So there's not a lot to get excited about in that regard. So that's perfectly natural. I mean, what there is flying. Which, of course, has not yet featured in
right.
The new Super Mario Bros. Games, because they've got the raccoon tail and they've got the P meter at the bottom and all that. So it seems like they're going to finally get into that again. And my real question is, you know, will there be anything really interesting done with it? Will we go to more Super Mario World kind of places with the flying? That would be something that would excite me. If it's just kind of a box-ticking thing because they've suddenly become raccoon fetishists or whatever after the...
Hey,
after
raccoons are smart.
After Super Mario 3D Land, then that isn't exciting at all. But at this point, it's so unclear. I don't know how much there is to draw from just a few screenshots. Obviously, we must assume E3 will reveal a great deal more about the game.
Well, yeah, because the game will be out like a month and a half later.
A couple of months later, yeah.
Yes.
But in terms of the time, because it talked about being a cash grab and all that, obviously it is, in the sense that, you know, this is a brand that is very powerful for them in the market. And that's, you know, I'm sure that's a lot of the reason why it looks the way it does. This is gold, you know, so...
Because it is. And that's where they make Gold Mario in the game.
And they make Gold Mario and Gold Enemies to go with it. But... The thing I would point out is that if you look at when it's coming out in the 3DS's life, it's roughly about, you know, 18 months into it or so. It's pretty similar to when New Super Mario Bros. Came out for the DS. So
yeah.
It doesn't really seem like it's been fast-tracked or anything. You know, I'm sure this is basically on schedule, apart from the fact that perhaps what Iwata said at the investors relations event suggested that they might have brought it forward a little bit because they want to space things out in terms of the second half of the year,
right.
Something for late summer because they're going to concentrate on Wii U in the Christmas Thanksgiving period. So,
I think the fact it's in August is actually a good thing because that means it's that they must have 3DS games slotted behind it.
Yeah, Animal Crossing.
In Japan, Animal Crossing is undoubtedly going to be, you know, one of the huge titles at the end of the year because it is a juggernaut in Japan.
Sure. And I mean, I wonder if they've got other stuff slotted out too, like, oh, I don't know, maybe Luigi's Mansion 2.
Well, it's Luigi's Mansion and Paper Mario that are still out there that, you know, they haven't got any more committal on when those are actually coming out.
Let me tell you right now, Paper Mario is not coming out this year anywhere.
Well, I think there's nothing sort of extraordinary about when it's coming out in the stage of the system's life. And, you know, pretty much what we're looking at now is three Mario side-scrollers in 6 years. It's more regular than when they went, you know, 15 years without one. That's for sure. But, you know, obviously prior to that point, they had quite a few, a short period of time. It's really a question of the game design.
And that is, yeah, the timing is not really my problem here. It's more what we've seen of it, and also what we have been led to expect based on the first two games, is that this game just isn't going to be all that original. And that's my problem with it. If, you know, look, if Nintendo wants to release a completely new, incredibly fresh and creative Mario platformer every single year from here to eternity, you won't see me complaining. Okay, it's not the frequency, it's what these games are.
But of course, where it ties into the frequency is it just that doesn't seem feasible, does it? You know,
right.
I'm sure it isn't. I think if you were more obviously drawing from different influences in the Mario universe, as the 8-bit deep kind of suggestive cribbing from Super Mario Bros. 2, or the Super Mario Bros. USA, as it's known in Japan, then I think people would have a sort of instant recognition if it was visual, all this kind of stuff. Oh, this is something different. It could even be misleading, you know, like, I mean, it's like with Super Mario 3D Land, you might have inferred from the early stuff with all the hints about the raccoon tail that there'd be a lot of flying in it when there was no such thing. You know, so I don't know how excited you want to get just by sort of those kind of visual differences, but one of the areas that I would say you would be, I've played the USA Super Mario 2, I like it, but I think one of the reasons why it was pretty much a non-starter is because that wasn't Mario 2 in Japan.
No, it was Doki Doki Panic.
They did release it ultimately as Super Mario Bros. USA over there, and it is on Super Mario All-Stars, mm-hmm. but I don't think it has the same kind of cherished memories in Japan that it does elsewhere in the world.
Well, no, but neither does Kid Icarus, and they went back to that well eventually.
Well,
so
yeah, they did go back to that well, but this is one of their big sellers. This is, and of course, as we've seen from what Iwata was showing the data at the investors conference, right now Japan is so far out in front of the other markets in terms of 3DS software that with this a flagship game for the 3DS, you are going to want to kind of focus on the Japanese market. So it's no surprise to me that they wouldn't go to this more of a cultural touchstone outside of Japan.
But, you know, I definitely agree with 8-Bits Deep on the fact that the Doki Doki Panic or Super Mario Bros. 2/USA, whatever you want to call it, that gameplay and that world are fertile ground in the sense that, hey, if Nintendo's going to be like remixing a bunch of crap from old Mario games, at least remix some stuff that hasn't already been remixed.
Yeah, well, the Super Mario Bros. 3 well has been tapped a little bit in recent times.
Has it?
You know, it's funny because I know the game is sort of thought of as having been Mario-ized for the West, but actually it was a Mario game to start with.
Yeah, it was far more of a like sequel than Super Mario 2 for Super Players in Japan because
right.
It was actually made by the same people. It was their next platformer.
Yeah, it was meant to be a Mario game, but they decided not to release because Tanabe decided it wasn't fun enough. But it was supposed to be a co-op game. So I like, that seems to dovetail really nicely with the new Super Mario Bros. Franchise.
Hey, if nothing else, I would love for them to revisit the music style of Mario 2.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's got some great soundtrack.
Oh, yeah,
it does. Absolutely. Definitely another thing that's not been the strongest in the new Super Mario Bros. Games.
No. Even in 3D Land, there's just not much original music at all.
3D Land's a lot worse musically because of the reuse. I mean, it's mostly original stuff with New Super Mario Bros. And, you know, the main theme is exactly what a Mario main theme should be. And some of the castle stuff is good. But again, if for nothing else, for freshness sake, you know, if they could broaden that out and start referencing stuff like Mario 2 or some of the other games, that would be pretty nice. But I don't know. I think the problem is their priority seems to be to kind of reassure people that this is really the next in line because it has sold so very well. It does seem like they are going to keep sticking close to that template until it stops selling that well.
I feel like they're kind of applying the Pokemon conservatism to franchises that actually really care about. I like Pokemon fine, right. but I don't get very excited for new Pokemon games because I kind of know what the deal is, right? With that franchise. And I don't want to feel that way about Mario and Zelda and Metroid and Kirby.
Well, I mean, the simultaneous multiplayer for Wii was a big selling point, and I think a lot of people had a lot of fun with it.
Sure.
And therefore, I think the point being that with this game here, it's a kind of question we've asked about a number of things, like, you know, the Wii U itself. What's the hook? Definitely we haven't seen that yet. Just adding some flying golden stuff. You know, those are not hooks. So no. I'd be fascinated to see if they've got something that really could be described, you know, a simple sort of addition that you can market very clearly and all that. This is the reason to buy the game. Personally, I'm sure if it's just more complicated levels with flying built in and like alternate exits and all that kind of stuff, I could absolutely enjoy that. I think that the level design was an improvement in New Super Mario Bros. Wii, and so I'm hoping for more of that. But beyond that, I'm not sure what to expect.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough. So John has the next letter.
All right, Jet Pilot writes, am I the only one that has no desire to purchase a downloadable full-price game, for example, New Super Mario Bros. 2, while Nintendo's games are tied to the hardware's infrastructure? It's one thing if my hardware dies and I lose a $5 time waster. It's another to be losing $40 games. Second, there are 3 3DSs in my house. I own one, and both of my sons have a 3DS. So it is not uncommon for me to purchase one copy of a game and have the boys share it.
Fight over it.
That allows them to have more variety in their gaming library. Unlike Apple's or Sony's system, under Nintendo's current system, we can only install the game on one piece of hardware. It's totally unacceptable. Our gaming budget is only so big and does not allow for us to buy multiple copies of games. If Nintendo wants to have a successful downloadable market for full-size games, they need to do away with linking games to specific pieces of hardware. Right now, Nintendo plans to release the games alongside retail copies, but we all know that the industry plan is to eventually do away with retail copies. This does not mesh with Nintendo's antiquated system of hardware-specific downloads. What are your thoughts on this?
Then buy the hard copy.
Well, yeah, this is a huge deal. Obviously, we haven't really talked about it on the show before that Nintendo, I mean, earlier in the year, they'd started kind of moving in this direction. They'd indicated that they would, you know, Nintendo right. Network, all this stuff. And now we're seeing this sort of crystallize that we're going to have, you know, most of their first party games are going to release on 3DS digital and retail. And yep. then on Wii U as well from day one. And that's what's really kind yeah. of, you know, the seismic shift of this is that, you know, we're less than a year removed from the launch of the eShop after the launch of the system. And right. now we're talking about, you know, a Mario game launching on 3DS simultaneously, digital and retail. That is quite a turnaround
yeah.
in that period of time. I mean, this was an episode that we did when Carl was on the show, but not because his audio screwed up. But we had a question from someone who was basically, you know, upset about Resident Evil Revelations being $50, which of course it didn't end up being $50. But, right. you know, say, wouldn't it be great if we could just download it and therefore you wouldn't have the problem of it being $50 because of an expensive card. And, you know, Johnny and I, this was at the end of last year, were like, well, yeah, it'd be nice, but it's not going to happen. And I mean, there's a lot of reasons for that. First of all, the price wouldn't be lower was one of them if they did. And that is the case here. They're going to suggest the same price for retailers, whether it's digital or physical. But I think also just because our experience with Nintendo up to that point, you know, you wouldn't think that they'd achieve that so quickly, especially on 3DS. You know, Wii U, it's a new platform. Maybe they can,
right.
you know, start fresh and all this kind of stuff. But to reach this point, especially because we've talked about a new business, you know, I mean, on the one hand, they're piddling about with Game Boy releases and all that. Like they don't care or they don't know what they're doing. But on the other hand, they're doing this. It's quite difficult to reconcile.
Yeah. There's a dichotomy going on here within Nintendo's download business plan that just seems to have this highly, I mean, it's not ambitious, because you can already do this on its competitors. But in a sense, it's ambitious for them. And then you have this incredibly retrograde philosophy on Virtual Console.
It is kind of ambitious for them, of course, but it is kind of trailblazing as well. Because what they're doing is to try and actively include retailers in the yep. process. And if you read through what Iwata says in the investor relations stuff, the Q&A, all that, it seems very clear that 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 is actually a very big part of the purpose, is the idea that if you sell retail games digitally through actual retailers, it is going to be their way of introducing people to the eShop. That it's going to be some sort of gateway drug for them to eventually just start purchasing things digitally, you know, whether it be eShop exclusive games, old games, or the new ones.
Yeah, Wired actually compared this to Nintendo trying to navigate between Scylla and Charybdis. I mean, that they have to walk this weird line of appeasing the retailers, whom they still can't divorce themselves from.
And this was exactly the point that when Johnny and I were poo-pooing the idea of Revelations ever being downloaded, that Nintendo have the best relationship with retailers, especially compared to Sony with their handheld stuff, that they wouldn't want to jeopardize it. And so they don't seem a likely candidate to jump into this digital future with 2 feet. But of course, here we see the difference. They are going to try and include them. And you know, what they're going to be doing is basically selling them codes. And then they set their own price, kind of like they would with physical copies of games.
So if you're a bargain hunter, it's incentive for you to actually go to the store rather than just be lazy and download everything at home, because you might save a couple bucks. But look, Nintendo is very, very smart about how they're doing this. I'm kind of amazed at how ingenious their proposal is, because it gives everyone more options. I mean, it does protect their relationship with retailers, or at least it offends it less than it would be if they weren't doing it this way. But it gives the consumer so many choices. You can buy virtually every game they're going to release as a first party, either at retail or download, and you can download it at home, or you can go to the retailer and let them try to, you know, haggle with you. And it is really a win-win for everybody. There's really, I don't think, anything to complain about here, except you're probably going to want to buy a bigger memory card. But they use they use a non-proprietary format, so you can haggle on that too.
Yeah, it's not like the Sony bullshit where they've got that crazy card that everybody has to buy.
Exactly.
Yeah. Which, well, the thing is, I think what he's getting at though is how Iwata has come out and said that they're not going to price the downloadable versions any lower.
Well, no, but as we said, it's a two-pronged thing, though, because they're going to give these codes to the retailers, and retailers could set the price. So it's going to be up to the retailers to some extent. Do they want to make it lower or that? You know, Nintendo's not going to mandate that it's lower. And what Iwata's also talked about is pretty much what Johnny's saying. You're giving the consumers the option, and then essentially the market is going to decide whether is the digital version more desirable or is the physical version more desirable. And that, the variables in that are very many, because, you know, obviously you've got people's lifestyles or people's preferences, all that stuff. And then you've got different kinds of games, because, you know, Animal Crossing, we've always brought that is the kind of game, and Iwata referenced that specifically too, that you probably would benefit from having it always on your system, because you want that quick dip in, that check-in play.
And when I was talking about Animal Crossing during the show, when I was playing it, I explicitly said, man, I wish I could just have this installed on my 3DS. Well, apparently I will.
Exactly. And the point is, you might be someone that in other respects prefers to have the box, or you want to shop around for deals and stuff and all that. But for just that one special case, just for Animal Crossing or something like it, you know, maybe like a Picross 3D sequel, you know, that's another game that I'd love to always have there rather than have to fish out the game cards. You know, you could pick and choose to do this stuff. And that's why I do like that idea of it. But there's actually a slide in what his presentation that lays these out specifically. It's almost set up to have trade-offs, because you know, they're saying these are the advantages of it and these are the disadvantages of it, and it's kind of like everyone's going to pick theirs. And one of them is what Jet Pilot talks about, is the fact that people can't share games. So the point is that they're not really going to necessarily address the problem that Jet Pilot talks about in terms of having an account system where you could download it and install it to different units of the same hardware, because they see basically as kind of like one of the differentiating factors, and therefore for people who are concerned, as Jet Pilot is, about their budget and, you know, sharing out games amongst a family, the hard copy is for them.
Yeah, but I don't see this as being a real problem, and no offense to Jet Pilot, but for one thing, you still have the option to buy games retail. So right. If you don't like this, don't go in for it. You can, you know, the old way is still available to you. You can make a slippery slope argument and say, well, but this is going down a path where eventually I will no longer have that option. Maybe that's true, but I don't think Nintendo is going to be the reason that we end up in that place. And I think Nintendo is going to allow you the option to buy your games physically for longer than just about anybody else.
Yeah, again, they're more sensitive to that concern, you know, by actually including the retailers in the process.
You know, what I thought was interesting in Kohler's article that he pointed out is that, and actually we spoke about this a bit, so this all came out right after we finished recording last week.
Yeah.
So we had this long, unrecorded discussion that would have been awesome podcast material, but we talked about how Nintendo kind of did this a little bit when they released the cards of Kid Icarus 3D to GameStop.
3D Classic. It was an temporary exclusive, wasn't it, in the States?
They kind of laid some groundwork here. But what Kohler points out in his article is by Nintendo's pricing strategy, where they're going to sell codes wholesale to retailers that they could charge whatever they want for, they're basically saying, look, we're not going to have a price war with you. If you want to have a price war, you win by default. Congratulations. You're always going to be the cheapest option if you want to be.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, presumably retailers are going to be the more attractive destination here because you are probably are going to get good deals on them and you are going to get competition.
Yeah, especially on Amazon, because you won't even have to wait for shipping. So if Amazon does some kind of loss leader deal where they're trying to bundle or, you know, they're trying to just get you to spend more time at their website so you buy more stuff overall.
Well, I think Amazon actually used to sell Xbox Live Arcade codes, did they not?
They still do, as far as I know. They're usually the same price as on the store, but that's probably Microsoft's policy.
Yeah, because I remember they used to have them on sale.
Yeah, like they would occasionally put them on sale, which was psychotic. It's like, hey!
Yeah, and I think they actually stopped doing that.
Yeah, but, you know, I feel like this idea of, you know, the limitation of digital in terms of game sharing is a strange concept to me. And I've never used PlayStation game sharing and I've never owned more than one iPod at a time. So these features are just not useful for me. And clearly for people like Jet Pilot, they are, if you have a family and you have multiple devices and everything, but mm-hmm. I don't really see the problem here because if we're talking about Wii U games, which we now know will be basically day and date digital releases, at least for Nintendo's first party stuff and some third party at least, even in family situations, you're generally not going to own multiple Wii U's. So I don't really think that's an issue. And then in terms of handhelds, if you've got three 3DSs in the house and only one of them has the new game downloaded to it, and you want to share it with another person, why don't you just lend them your 3DS and you take theirs? Materially, the only difference between your systems is that one has the game and the other doesn't. So if you're done playing the game, just swap.
Yeah, I don't know. Your kids may complain, though. You know, if, he has my 3DS, whatever.
But they still have a 3DS. Like, you've just temporarily traded systems with someone that you presumably trust. I mean, I just don't understand why you can't swap out.
I think it would make sense for them to have like a 5-device sharing thing like they do on PSN.
Except they would prefer for you to buy multiple copies. So yeah. There's zero incentive for them to do this.
If you look at what they've been saying, that's not in the plan at the minute. That's the way they're approaching it. Like I said, it's almost like they're deliberately setting up this choice. You know, it's kind of what Jetpilot is saying is that I would, if we're going to have a digital future, I want it to be like a best case scenario digital. And that's not really what Nintendo are going for. It is more like the complementary option. But I think there's a bit the issue that I think is definitely sort of legitimate that's raised is the idea of, you know, well, what happens if something goes wrong with your system?
Yeah.
It's never been a problem for me with my Wii's, you know, with the Japanese one, all it could be one day. Yeah. And I'm sure there are experiences people might have had that could be quite bad in terms of getting their stuff back, if you like, the stuff that they'd already paid for. And of course, with 3DS, you know, it's a bit different because, it could break or something. Thing and you have to send it in for repairs or this, that, or the other, but you could lose it altogether. And then what is your recourse for getting those games back?
Well, I think there does have to be some mechanism of account, but it probably is going to have to rely on Nintendo.
I mean, you've got some sort of Club Nintendo integration, yeah. So maybe that could be used. But I think there's some valid concerns that there's not, yes, like at the moment anyway, a transparent mechanism for, like, you know, the bottom line is, you know, I paid for the license to download this thing and I shouldn't have lost it just because, you know, the physical unit goes missing and everything's tied to it. So they need a more upfront approach, you know, and maybe this is something that the retailers could communicate to the customers, since that they're being sort of outsourced this kind of awareness role, because it would be a natural question to ask. It's like, well, hang on a minute, you know, what happens if it gets stolen or something?
I mean, this has been a problem for a while with Nintendo. On Wii, it didn't matter too much because you're not likely to lose your Wii. And if it broke, you would send it to Nintendo and they would offer to recover it for you. But yeah, I mean, 3DS is a portable system. You can lose it. And if you lose it, then you're going to lose the games that are on it. And sure, Nintendo knows probably through your Club Nintendo account that you bought the game, but they don't know that you actually lost the system. You might just still have it and say, hey, I want to download it. So, you know, they might assume that you're just trying to get free copies for a second system. So yes, they need a way to be able to deauthorize the licenses, which is the way Apple does it. For instance, if you lose your iPod and you say, hey, I want you to deauthorize that device so that I can use that license on a new device. And that is a useful feature to have. And I don't think any of us are going to argue against Nintendo implementing something like that. They need to have it. But this is not a new problem. I think the only reason that JetPilot has brought it up in this case is because, you know, retail games cost more. So you have more to lose, but it's fundamentally exactly the same issue that already existed with eShop and with DSiWare.
But you are, when you raise the stakes like this, yeah, the dollar amounts that we're talking
sure,
about.
It's going to get more attention.
But also, the whole point is that, right, let's get people, you know, who right now probably wouldn't be doing a lot of shopping on the eShop to start doing it. And they might not be people that have got, you know, Club Nintendo accounts, LinkedIn, and all this kind of stuff. So again, you've got to broaden it.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, I'm just saying, in principle, this issue has been around since 2009 when DSi launched. So they absolutely need to fix it.
I mean, like I said, this whole sort of the idea that they're setting up of just like, well, here's the pros and cons of both that you decide. You do fear it's possible that you, to some extent, is going to be just like, well, that's the risk you take kind of thing, which would be a shame if that's how it turns out, to say the least.
Okie doke. Well, the next email is from Denna, who writes, in the fall, I have the privilege of being able to study abroad in Florence, Italy for a year. As excited as I am to see another continent, because I live in the States, I can't help but be slightly concerned about my gaming habits. I know I won't have nearly as much time to game as usual, but I'm sure there will be times when I just want to sit on my ass and game for a bit. My main question is, what are the main gaming difficulties I will face going to another country? I'm not sure which consoles are region locked, nor am I familiar with the game import process. For my 3DS, can I download games as I normally would? Or does being in Europe mean I can't download American games? Any information you guys could give me would be greatly appreciated.
All right, let's deal with the download issue first. Obviously, I have a Japanese Wii that downloads Japanese games. I am not in Japan. And it's much the same with the 3DS.
Yeah, so Don has...
Don Koopman, yeah. He's in Holland, and he's downloading Japanese games to his Japanese 3DS. So obviously, your American 3DS will still connect to the American eShop, even when you're doing so from Florence.
Yeah, they don't do IP checking, which I think some of Sony's systems do.
And I mean, for a portable system, it's even more natural that it shouldn't.
They do some IP checking, though, on video content.
Oh.
So, the Nintendo Video Service, it's funny because we have a staff member right now who is out of country, and they only get video when they go home. So, even though they're in the same Nintendo region, they only get video when they're, like, arrive at the airport on return trips home.
Yeah, that might be related to rights, you know, contracts and all that kind of stuff. So, but with the 3DS eShop, I mean, it's more the case, isn't it? Because you might travel with that and you might still want to connect to the eShop and buy a game to play while traveling. You know, the case with me with my Japanese Wii is it stretches credibility a little more in that
I'm just
regard.
Traveling.
So you're fine on that front. Now, I mean, one thing you're going to want is a different charger.
You could get a converter.
You could get a converter, but that'd be a bit much to have just for that. I mean, I don't think it's that hard to get a different charger, maybe.
No, I mean, obviously, you can buy the chargers for all these systems in their native region, and the hardware itself is more or less identical, so it's just swapping the chargers out.
Yeah, it's just swapping the chargers. So whatever's cheaper, maybe you could, if you found a step down really cheap, and you could use it for more than one thing if you had more than one American.
Right.
Those can be quite useful.
That could be good for resolving that whole voltage difference issue. But now, of course, the bigger problem would have been, aren't you going to get an issue with if you want to buy new physical 3DS games? The 3DS is region locked in a quite contrary to all of Nintendo's previous portables. I guess that always felt like the thing with portables in the past. They didn't have TV compatibility issues like consoles, you know, NTSC and PAL. And the idea is you might travel with them. So why not have them be region free? And of course, with 3DS, they went away from that. And so you will have an issue there. You know, games you buy in Italy are not going to work with your US 3DS. Of course, Nintendo's digital awakening is going to help you quite a lot.
Yeah, congratulations.
You know, you could buy them straight off the eShop, or you could go buy codes off Amazon.com and then just put that code in. That is going to be quite helpful.
You could even import a Wii U from the States if you're still out there in November when it launches. You wouldn't want to buy a local Wii U unless you want to be buying European games for the next 5 years. But you could import the system from America and then just download all your games, retail or otherwise, from the American Wii shop or whatever it is, and play them there. Yeah. So that would work great. That solves a lot of your region locking problem.
But yeah, I mean, I can give a quick rundown of what the region locking situation is on the hardware devices.
Sure. If Dena owns more than one system, sure.
Yeah. I did a little bit of research on this ahead of time. So the PS3 is region free, but PS2 games are still region locked. Also, some DLC is weird. Like, you have to be logged in as a certain country's account. It's
yeah, you can make different accounts. That's how I've got Japanese PS1 games and stuff.
Yeah, the Wii is region locked, but it's utterly trivial to get around it.
True. Yes, very easy.
It's ridiculously simple.
It's easy if you find a good guide that will take you through. It's several steps long. It'll take you probably an hour to set it up.
I didn't take me that long, but still, it's more or less trivial.
Compared to GameCube, where you had to solder a circuit.
Right.
And it doesn't cost anything either.
Right, it's a soft, free hack that you can do.
Yeah, the 360 is kind of region locked. Some games are region locked and some aren't, but there are lists out there. I'd say the majority aren't. UMDs on PSP is region free if you are weird enough to own a PSP with UMDs.
Surely owning a PSP Go is more weird, judging
from
the sales of that thing.
That's very true.
DSi enhanced games aren't region free, but as we said, DS games are. The 3DS, as we said, is region locked, but obviously with the download, that's on situation. Vita retail games are region free. Download stuff, though, again, it's the accounts.
Yeah, you have to set up an account. But again, that's pretty easy to do, I think.
Yeah, but yeah, I think if I'm reading it correctly, I believe you have to have a different of the Sony memory card for each account.
Yeah, I think that the people were very annoyed about that.
Yes, because yeah, they're pricey. But yeah, so that's basically all the basics that you got going on right now.
Okay. Well, good luck, Dena. Let us know how it goes. It is certainly can be nice to have a few video games to comfort you when you're lonely in a foreign land. Hopefully that won't be too big of a problem for you. But yeah, like I said, if you're going to have more options than certainly I did when I studied abroad. So I brought all my games with me, and the only thing I bought when I was in Russia was a bootleg copy of Driver 2 for GBA.
Why would you bootleg Driver 2 for GBA?
Well, everything's bootleg in Russia, James.
So yeah, that's true.
Wasn't that unusual at the time, really. Okay, Greg has the final email this week.
Eric from Austria writes, listening to your last podcast, Johnny mentioning Fez and his love for obscure titles made me think about a game released recently over here. It was always considered the weakest of three brothers, the little one that gets dragged along everywhere, but still staying in the shadows and out of sight. You've probably guessed it by now. I am, of course, talking about Pandora's Tower, the stepchild of the Operation Rainfall games. In retrospect, I would have never guessed that the game expected to be the best, The Last Story, would end up as the worst of the three Rainfall games. Yes, I said it. Pandora's Tower is better than The Last Story, and it's a damn shame no one gives a fuck, because mostly no one knows what this game is about. It is not so much an RPG, it's more like Zelda meets 3D Castlevania meets Shadow of the Colossus. Mm. It starts out like Shadow by throwing you into this world you know nothing about, yet it gives you an objective and a vague idea why you should do it. And then you're on your own, exploring Zelda-style dungeons with light Castlevania-style fighting. Everything is set in a really depressing tone. You are practically forced to murder some peaceful enemies that serve as this game's bosses. And every time I rip their heart out with my chain, with them trying to reach for it with their last breath, it really makes me feel bad in a bizarre way. There aren't many games that show you that what you are doing isn't always justifiable. And then, when you get the heart, you serve it to your love interest. This is far from a vegetarian society. And she will be forced to eat it, and while doing so, always pukes towards the camera. Throw in a full-fledged dating sim into the mix, and you've got a really, really disturbing, but on the other hand, pretty mature game that deals with much more than just kill the terrorists, they are evil. Hours of skimming game-related boards later, NeoGAF included, this game with its mature tone sounds like a natural fit for a certain demographic. So I wonder, is Pandora's Tower just too bizarre for a Western audience? Or is it more of a combination of different factors like not knowing anything about it, the gaming press not helping at all, being unfairly considered a weak game, etc., that hinders its success? Oh, and by the way, Dr. Metz, this is a game for you. I would eat three broomsticks if you'd consider Fez to be weirder than this.
It certainly does sound intriguing, although to me, from the description, it sounds more like a James thing than a Johnny thing.
Yeah.
But I'm certainly intrigued after that description. Pushing
the limits of rationality and gameplay design. it honestly feels a bit like the game was designed with the intention of trolling the fuck out of Nintendo corporate. Like, all right, we're going to go crazy.
All right, eat the heart, now puke. High fives all around.
It's like, if I could have been in the room when Iwata had this demoed for him the first time, just to see the look on his face, like, really? This is what you brought me, huh?
It was probably the same look as when Yamauchi got the Go simulator for Famicom.
There's a pretty entertaining Iwata asks on the European site where some of these issues are broached, actually, but they conceived of it and all that. I mean, it is intriguing. Certainly, we've talked the gameplay feature we did and all that about disassembling, you know, what is the gameplay and how important the context is. And it's a really interestingly elaborate attempt to give more urgency and to weight to what you're doing. That you've basically got this, you know, girlfriend character that's being mutated into some sort of snail creature, you know, and if you don't get these juicy hearts back to her in time, she'll get more and more deformed and more pissed off with you at letting her get deformed and all this sort of thing. But to be honest, what I find interesting about the game is some of the elements of the combat system, like using the pointer in conjunction with the buttons to actually direct this whip, you know, this flail chain.
Oh, that is cool.
Doing those sorts of precision kind of maneuvers like that, it sounds really interesting. I mean, definitely from the reviews that you've seen over here, it sounds like a game that has some certain rough edges, not just visually, but, you know, a bit in the game design as well. But it's the kind of thing I would probably, you know, entertain playing, but not a day one purchase, maybe not a full price purchase. So, you know, I might get around to it. And there certainly has been some, you know, we've heard of maybe a few little indications that it might come to America. We had some reports in from a listener of ours who comments frequently on our articles, Joe, who had spoken with a GameStop employee or something. It kind of led him to think that it might come out in the States. Who knows? I mean, I'm not sure the UK performance is, at least. Maybe it did better in continental Europe. But in the UK, I think it debuted at number 38 on the All Formats chart or something and was never seen again.
I've got good news for you guys, because sales prospects have never been a hindrance to XC localizing something for
nope.
Yeah, that's true.
And you know, I think you know, we talked a lot about it when it was first announced, but the fact that XSEED is being given the opportunity to publish the last story over here is very, very important, not just for that one game, but for future games as well. And maybe even beyond the whole Operation Rainfall thing. But, you know, I think for XSEED, if the last story, I'm not even gonna say if it sells well, if the whole process of them going through it, if they're pleased with that, if they're happy working with Nintendo, if they feel like they got a good deal on the whole thing, then I can definitely see them going forward and doing Pandora's Tower as well. To me, though, this also sounds very much like an Atlas thing. And not to say that
it's weird enough for them.
It sounds a little bit like Catherine, and Atlas managed to sell 500,000 copies of Catherine last year.
Well, that's because her boobies are on the box. I mean,
maybe so. And Atlas has a very devoted following who will buy almost anything they publish, and that following is probably big enough to meet the break even on a game like Pandora's Tower, which they could probably publish for next to nothing. So. You know, I think a company like that also has a good shot. And now that XSEED has sort of proven that it can be done, and they've broken Nintendo's will in terms of allowing third parties to publish their games overseas when they don't want to, you know, I think one of those two companies, that I think there's maybe like a 50-50 chance that it could actually happen. And I would have never said that before the whole last story announcement, which is to me still one of the most unlikely and unpredictable things that's happened in a very long time with Nintendo. But now that that has happened, I'm going to eat the crow and say, hey, Pandora's Tower, why not?
Well, one of the things from the investor relations stuff that Iwata was putting out, all that, is that there isn't a lot for the Wii coming in North America for the rest of the year leading up to the Wii U's launch. I mean, I think there's some indications that America, like Europe, might get the Fatal Frame 2 remake. You know, and then there's the bizarre Necromancy of Pikmin 2 new play control.
Oh my god.
Rise from your grave!
But you know, maybe that dearth of content gives a somewhat better chance for Pandora's Tower getting a shot from someone. But it was definitely the weakest performer in Japan. And it doesn't have the acclaim either. Obviously, Eric would disagree, as we've heard. But with publishers looking at it, that might count against it, unfortunately.
Right.
It does have this kind of like Suda 51 cult hit vibe around it, doesn't it? Like a game that a few people will become really obsessed with. And that kind of thing has worked out. I mean, what was that Deadly Premonition?
Oh, God. Well, that game's different, though. That game has got the so bad it's good thing going on, too.
I guess there's some of that, but it was released as a budget title in America, and it did very well for that publisher because the expectations and the barrier of entry was very low. And it got plenty of buzz because it's so bizarre, you know, that people started talking about it. And some, you know, a lot of people said, well, I don't even know what this is, but for $20, there must be something about it because all these people are talking about it. I'm going to go pick it up. And, you know, I think Pandora's Tower could maybe work in that kind of mold. I don't know if it's economically viable, but beyond this one game, which does sound totally weird and hilarious, and I would love to play it at some point, especially, you know, if you can legitimately compare it to Shadow of the Colossus, it certainly sounds thematically like that is a justifiable comparison. I think that's fascinating, and I would love to check it out for myself. But even beyond this, what came out of this investor meeting that we've brought up over and over again, the quote that gave me the most joy, the most encouragement for the future of Nintendo and the most appreciation for Satoru Iwata is his recognition that, you know, one of the investors asked him about sort of the core gamers and their approach and their strategy and what they've learned about it. And Iwata admitted that with Wii, he certainly didn't express any regret about the whole Blue Ocean thing that they did and the success that they had. But he said that we messed up our messaging a little bit, and a lot of people who had been Nintendo players for a long time drifted away from Wii because they felt that it wasn't for them. And
right. And
that wasn't true. It was for them, but we didn't get that message across. We didn't put out the games that they wanted, and we didn't communicate the strategy effectively. We didn't make them feel included in what we were doing. We made them feel like we were going after these new people at the expense of the traditional fans, which is something that we fed on that topic for years on this podcast. So, you know, obviously it resonates with me and a lot of people. And the fact that Iwata acknowledges that and understands it in great detail, I think, in his answer, gives me so much hope that this whole catastrophe of the Operation Rainfall games, which is being salvaged in the best way you could have hoped for after years of stupidity on Nintendo's part, I do get the sense that they're not going to let this happen again, or at least that's their intention.
Yeah, it's interesting. What he said was specifically, we found that it's very difficult to change people's perceptions of something once they've decided that something's not for them.
No shit.
which, yeah, fair enough. And that's, and you know, with 3DS, it seems like, yeah, you could see they are kind of doing it the other way around. Let's reach out a bit later. You know, the stuff like Tomodachi Collection and Animal Crossing and stuff in Japan is kind of coming after that. You've already had Monster Hunter and Mario and Zelda and all this sort of stuff, but and presumably Wii U is going to follow the same path. But I would argue that that cuts both ways. One of the reasons why the Wii was so successful with the mainstream was because it reached out to them at the start, and so they didn't get to decide that it wasn't for them,
right,
and let it pass into the night and never consider buying one. And so I'm not so confident as he appears to be that they can have their cake and eat it on this one.
I agree. But being a core gamer, I also kind of don't care about those other people.
Well, so, you know, that's...
I can't complain about him catering to me more than he has in the past.
Well, and it's always easier to go from the hardcore to the casual rather than the casual to the hardcore.
Well, that's it, but that's always been the orthodoxy. You know, the price gets lower and all this, and then we reach out. And that's the way a lot of consoles have done it. But I would argue not going that way is one of the big reasons why Wii was as successful as it was. There are trade-offs here, and they are choosing. And yeah, they're probably choosing in our favor. So that's hunky-dory. But business-wise, I'm not convinced.
I mean, I think you're right. It seems like it's either one way or the other, just because... I mean, really, like, there hasn't been a Nintendo console in a long time that has catered to both sides of the coin.
Greg, to your point about them having to choose, not to choose the focus, but it's almost like you can only be outlandishly successful with one group or the other. You can't have it both ways. I think there is some truth in that. But at the same time, I think it's probably wise for Nintendo to choose to focus on the core gamers, because I think the success that they had with Wii in the mainstream casual sort of blue ocean market, they know they cannot repeat that success. They would love to, but I think they know that the market realities are very, very different today than they were in 2006.
I think that is absolutely part of what they're doing. It's what I've referred to before as a retrenchment strategy, and you see that with 3DS as well.
Yeah.
I think the point is exactly by his own words. You know, your system is defined to a large degree early on, and that I don't think it's so easy to just sort of rewrite history and then it becomes defined as something completely different so many years down the line. I'm not sure that anyone's messaging is good enough to achieve that.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, like when the Wii came out, I mean, I knew a bunch of guys that they all went out and they bought Twilight Princess and played through it. And then 6 months down the line, they were like, there doesn't really seem to be anything else following that up. So I'm getting a 360. And that was it. Wii was gone.
They still have it, but that doesn't help Nintendo because they're not buying games. And that's where Nintendo makes all their money. So
no, I mean, Nintendo, basically, the other thing that Iwata said was that, you know, the whole bridge game thing didn't happen.
And I was skeptical of that from the start.
But what they don't seem to be saying so much is like, well, we need to do a better job of making games that actually kind of transition the two, so much as just, you know, maybe abandoning the idea altogether.
Well, the problem there is the bridge thing worked because they were going from casual to hardcore, and they'd never really done that before, and that's why the concept of a bridge game didn't really exist before Wii. And it doesn't make as much sense, you know, the opposite direction to get hardcore players to play casual games. Other people already are doing that way better than Nintendo could ever hope for.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think what Nintendo realizes is that, and their investors made no beans about it, smartphone games are eating Nintendo's lunch right now. Mm-hmm. Because Nintendo set up a platform with Wii where, after a point, virtually the only people buying games for Wii anymore were casual players. They were buying Just Dance and Wii Sports Resort and Mario Kart. And at some point, those people no longer were interested in those games because they were spending all their money on phone games. And Nintendo, I think, probably rightly figures that they cannot win that market back.
Yeah.
Not with Wii U. Not with the kind of system Wii U is. I mean, maybe in another generation they'll figure out the way to do it, but it's not happening right now. And so their best bet is to go with the curmudgeons like me who are completely uninterested in playing games on smartphones because of the interface and other reasons, and still want to play a traditional style, let's sit down on the couch and play this game on my console in front of my TV. And there's plenty of money to be sucked out of guys like us. And they basically sacrificed a lot of that money last generation.
Well, the thing is, I mean, you might say that, you know, the hardcore won't, I mean, the hardcore is growing, right? Because the thing is, gamers now, they start playing games earlier. They start playing like their Xbox 360s when they're, you know, 10, 12 years old. And those people now keep playing games into their 30s, into their 40s.
They have kids and they teach them to play the games.
That's right. They're going to say, hey, and they're going to have a kid and then they're going to keep buying consoles. And that's the whole thing. So the hardcore, the quote unquote hardcore, is actually growing over time as gamers age.
All right. So thanks everybody for the awesome emails. Like I said, we have a lot more that we will get to soon. And you can keep sending those in. I'll have the address here in a minute. But first, before we end the show, it's time to make a special announcement, and I'll hand it over to Greg for the moment.
Yep, so if you're a regular listener to the show or someone has been listening to it for a long time, you probably heard every now and again we reference the fact that my editing of the show is very time-consuming process every week. It takes very many hours of a very large chunk of my weekend to do it. And you know, over the years, I've made plenty of concessions in my life to make that continue to work, to actually fit it in. I've edited about 170 episodes over the course of 3.5 years or more. And unfortunately, it's time for me to tell you that I've reached a point where I'm not going to be able to make that accommodation and fit it in anymore. I'm not going to have the time to do it. And the last thing that I want to do is start cutting corners and all that kind of stuff. And then someone has to come along and tell me that it's not good enough anymore. So I have been, over the past several months, training and coordinating with my replacement as editor. And that person is Guillaume Veillette, who you've been hearing from for the past few months. And if you haven't heard his excellent work over at Negative World, his podcast there, you probably have heard episode 289 of this show, which he edited sort of in secret and did a very good job. I think you'd agree.
That was the last episode, just in case you aren't paying attention to the numbers.
Indeed. So, yeah, he edited that and, you know, I was very pleased with the results. I think you'd agree. He's a very fine choice to carry on editing the show. But unfortunately, it doesn't end there because unlike, you know, people like James and Mike Sklens and all that sort of stopped editing the show but were able to keep appearing on it for some time. For me, pretty much, you know, a big part of my life has been organized around editing this and all that kind of stuff. And therefore, I've been able to also go through the not inconsiderable trouble of, you know, staying up till 5 a.m. as it is 5 minutes to five currently to record this show. But with the changes that are coming now, where I'm not going to be committed to editing it and all that, unfortunately, I won't be able to make it work with recording the show either. And so I will be back next week for my last episode. But after that, I will no longer be appearing on the show, which is very sad after 200 odd episodes. And certainly I probably won't miss editing that much. But I'm going to miss actually getting to talk about games with the people and interacting with the listeners a hell of a lot more.
So, you know, we'll have a chance next week on the next episode to fully say goodbye to Greg. This is a pretty big deal for us, of course, and it's very sad news for all of us, Greg included. But, you know, in some sense, it was probably inevitable considering the insane schedule that he's been keeping for the past few years and the incredible amount of work that he puts into it. And we will fully thank you next week, Greg. You know, I just want to say that we have not taken this situation lightly. Greg and I have been discussing it for literally for 6 months about what to do about it and how to handle it. And we spent a lot of time looking for the right person and talking to Guillaume and convincing him that he can do it. and making sure that he has all the right tools and the right skills, and then he has the experience. And so it's been a great pleasure actually to introduce him to the show sort of at a trickle pace over the past few months as a guest, to have him on the panel, and then finally last week to actually have him secretly edit a show just to prove to you all that that he can do it, and the quality can be consistent, and that we will be able to press on with the show. You know, of course it'll be different, but it will still be Radio Free Nintendo, and we're going to still keep doing it because we love to do it, and we hope that you'll stick with us as we sort of take the show into a new era. So remind you once again that the email address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and of course you can head over to the website and click on the show notes, and there will be a link there as well to send us an email. And you know, if you have a message that you want to leave for Greg, I think this would be a very good time to do it. So again, thanks for listening. We will all four be back one last time next week, right here on Radio Free Nintendo.
Yeah, so they actually, I was actually wrong. They joined the league in 92-93,
okay,
along with the Mighty Ducks of Anaheim.
Oh, yes. The movie, the team.
Were they named after the movie or the other way around?
Yes, they were. They are the movie, the team. They were owned by Disney.
Oh, my God.
Thanks, Gary Bettman. You're amazing.
Because here's the funny thing. Of course, again, I will say, never, ever, ever watch hockey when I was a kid. But I watched the Mighty Ducks over and over and over. That movie was on repeat in my household.
Eventually, they grew out of the movie 12 years later.
Well, they had to make it through Mighty Ducks 2 and Mighty Ducks 3. You know.
Yeah.
Isn't there a minor league baseball team named after another state camp? It's an Emilio Estevez gag. That's fine.
Oh, that was good.